good morning, everybody. Shabbat shalom. And it is indeed a great blessing. I'm still thankful that we can get together on Shabbat electronically like this and have people literally from all over the country and all over the world, and to let iron sharpen iron. So I hope that that'll be the case. Pray that that'll be the case this morning, and that what we talk about will be interesting, and also it'll give us a chance to have some interaction, perhaps more so than usual for reasons that I'll get to in a second. If you get questions, get them up. By the way, that goes for folks that are listening later online, too. I know that Kevin usually posts the links for emails and for things like that. But if you have feedback today especially, let me know, and I'll give my a couple of email addresses out on the recording here. One of them is mark@marknywatt.com. So marknywatt.com is my own website where I put stuff up, primarily articles, occasionally links to the audio as well. So the email through that one is just mark@marknywott.com for questions. The other place is through hebrewnation.net. And the email there is markc@hebrewnation.net. Any of those will work. So let's get started. This week's portion is Behar. And remember, the word be means in or on. And, of course, Har, like Har Sinai, is a mountain or a mount. So the thing that kind of sets this one apart is that it is Behar, on the mountain. And the initial sentence in chapter 25 of Vayikra or Leviticus is like so many others that we have, but with this one difference. Normally, it seems like many, many times it's the Torah portion starts off with, and Yahuwah spoke to Moshe saying. And that word and set of words appears so often that usually isn't the name of the portion. It's what it is that he says that is the first thing in the Hebrew that's different. But in this case, because it doesn't say exactly that, it says, and Yahuwah spoke to Moshe Behar, on the mountain, and in particular Sinai, saying these things. Speak unto the children of Israel, say to them, when you come into the land which I give you. I'll come back to that in a second, but I just want to point out, and by the way, usually on Erev Shabbat I'll go through a lot more detail and start at one end of the portion and go through to the other. Those recordings are available too, and certainly this morning with some of the other recordings and things we're talking about, we've already heard a lot of the specifics about it, so I'm going to address a couple of things that I want to pick out of here. But as far as the whole portion is concerned, I'm not going to do as much of that as I am focusing on some other specific areas. Some of those things, by the way, are themes that I know you've heard me hit a lot lately, and I'll just tell you up front, the reason why I'm hitting them again is because I feel, you know, you could say in your heart or I'm led, but I got the strongest sensation that these are things that are really important and that time draws short, at least so far as what we need to be understanding and beginning to get ourselves in line with, that we need to really, really focus on certain things. So a couple of those concepts are going to appear in here. Others will draw back in, and of course, as always, we'll talk about some of the things in the news. But I was talking about what's different about this portion, this idea that it's on Mount Sinai. And what the sages say, and I find this interesting, probably significant, you may or may not agree with it, but there's no question that somehow or other this piece is different than the other pieces. Normally, we don't see that this indication of where it is, as if it mattered, that Yod Heh Vav Heh spoke to him. And so what people say is, well, look, this is different for a reason. What's the reason? And maybe it has to do with the question of authorship. We already know that it says that Yod Heh Vav Heh spoke to Moshe over and over again. But so many of the things that he speaks to him telling him are things that we say, okay, well, that makes sense to me. That makes sense to me. So does that. And yet, a lot of times, in you know, when you speak to men, they'll say this, however, this doesn't make any sense at all. You're going to let the land go for 1 year out of seven and do nothing? And yeah, since you're not going to reap or sow or do a lot of things, turns out you're not just losing a year, you're losing more than 1 year, maybe three full years. You got to be nuts to do something like that. And that's why the sages say what this shows is divine authorship, because this set of commandments and instructions would seem completely irrational to any human that might try to write something like this. And furthermore, if it turned out not to be true, You know, the seventh year comes along, and people have been faithful, and it doesn't happen. Well, the first thing they're going to say is, well, this is no good. I'm not going to do this anymore. So what kind of a God, unless it was the real one, would write something like that? So that's where they come to this idea that the authorship is indicated here. As for me, you've heard me say things like this if you've listened very often for a long time. When I look at Scripture, when I read all the pieces and see just how consistent they are, literally from beginning to end, from Bereshit or Genesis to maps, that is, to my mind, the thing that speaks of authorship. It says, look, this is detail. This is the pieces fitting together in a way that no human being, not even with supercomputers at their disposal or group of humans, could have possibly put together and had work out this way. Oh, well, you know, there are inconsistencies in Scripture. I hear people say, well, you bet there are. But those are lousy translations. Those are cultural biases that men have interjected. The closer you get to the original language, even if it might in fact predate what we see in the copies we have in our hands, the more obvious it is that no human being could have written this. And this chapter 25 is an example of that. But it's the things that are in here that it speaks to that I think are probably even more appropriate today for the stuff I want to dwell on. Starts with verse 2. In the land. When you come into the land. Now, we're not in the land. Does this still apply? I'm not going to worry about that so much as I am about some of the symbolism here. And we'll talk a little bit more in the course of the day why that is, I think, more important and more appropriate than whether we're in or out of the land even. Because if we want to get back to the land, or if we realize, of course, the Scripture says that the land that was promised is bigger than the kingdoms of King David or Solomon or anybody else ever actually expanded to anyway, then we know that there's something ahead of us, which is a pretty darn wonderful set of promises. Better we just learn to walk in obedience and try to understand the concepts that he is telling us here so that we can figure the rest along the way. Back to the concept. When you come into the land which I give you, then you shall keep. No, you shall keep. See, we're used to reading it that way. What it says is, then the land shall keep a Sabbath unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. The land's going to keep a Sabbath? Does that make any sense? You know the details. 6 years, plow your field. Seventh year, it's going to bring forth. Well, actually, the sixth year, it brings forth enough to last for several years. The seventh year shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest, le'eretz, for the land. A Sabbath unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. You're not to sow your field nor prune your vineyard. And then we've got the specifics of it. But let's talk about the concept and why this is something that would imply divine authorship. Because, you know, who would do this otherwise? Can you see that to have a whole land of people literally sit back and say, okay, here comes the Shemitah year, the seventh year. Take a break, land. Do your rest thing. You know there's people saying you got to be kidding. You can imagine how that would go over in America. Yeah, we have science saying it turns out the land does better and so forth. That's wonderful. But we don't all have to do it in the same time, do we? The idea of sevens and ones kind of gives us another hint along these lines. We've seen in the last couple portions how over and over again this idea of this number of completion, sevens, that's his, completing the week and beginning the cycle anew, appears over and over again. So many of his feasts, not the Jewish feasts, certainly not the Christian feasts, but the feasts of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh involve combinations of sevens and ones. And this week we got combinations of seven times seven, seven times seven plus one even. And we've seen over the last few weeks, counting the Omer, the 50 days. Now we got the 50 years that lead up to the Yovel year or the Jubilee year. Too many patterns to be by chance. Too many things that kind of, if we step back and look at them, would cause us to kind of raise our eyebrows and say, wow, isn't that interesting, if nothing else. So it starts, of course, with the Sabbath. I had this discussion last night. Is the Sabbath for man? Well, certain scriptures say it is. It was instituted by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, but it's for man, this weekly Sabbath. It's a reminder. Remember my Sabbaths, keep them set apart. It's a reminder for us of so many things. And it is literally the building block of the pattern that everything else is based upon. Now we find we've got this Sabbath of years. 7 years. It's not for man this time, at least not directly. It's for the land. And you can spend a lot of time, and I've certainly talked about it in the past, taking a look at the issue of the land itself. And, you know, what does the land have desires? Can the land really understand taking rest? Well, understanding may not be the right word, but the Sabbath is for the land, we're told. Then we get to this 7 times 7 year thing, the Yovel year. I like the wording here. I'll read it in just a second. But it would seem to be kind of a combination of the others. That makes sense, doesn't it, mathematically? And now it's for the land, because this is when the land is going to revert those things in the land to go back to the original ownership and the families. And it's also about debt and bondage and redemption and release from bondage. And that certainly would appear to be for men, too. So if nothing else, even if we don't understand all the details, we can step back and see all the patterns of sevens and ones and 7 times 7 plus ones and his appointed times and his feast and his combinations of years that still have appointed times, Shemitah years and Jubilee years or years for Yovel. Oh, and what's the other piece of this whole thing? Well, it has to do with faith. If I haven't mentioned that already, you're going to set aside an entire year and not sow a field or reap the field, and you're going to expect that there's going to be enough. He says so. He says there'll be enough. I will command my blessing upon you in the 6th year. It shall bring forth produce for 7 years. Chapter 25, verses 19 through 22 is where I'm reading. The land, it says, shall yield her fruit, and you shall eat till you have enough and dwell therein in safety. Some of the sages over the years have pointed out, hey, we got a similar thing going on when the men of the land are called in the Feast of Ascension, those three appointed times each year when they're supposed to literally leave their fields and go up to the place where I shall put my name. What? They're going to leave their fields and their animals unprotected. Well, maybe there's some women that can help do this. But what about invasion? Don't they worry about the fact that if there was an invader that wanted to come into the land at that point, that'd be the ideal time to do it. All the guys are away. Let's go whack on the rest. Answer, somebody's taking care of it. All of these things, in other words, again, imply divine authorship, because somebody has to have faith that the creator that wrote this stuff is truly going to keep his end of the bargain up and do what he says he will do, which is right here in these verses, 20 through 22. What shall we eat in the 7th year, if you're wondering? Behold, we can't sow or gather in our increase. Answer, of course, faith, trust in him. I will command my blessing upon you in the 6th year. It'll bring enough for 3 years forward, and you shall sow the 8th year and eat of the produce till the 9th year. Kind of amazing, isn't it? All right, back to this line that I said I was going to skip over but come back to, because I think it's so wonderful. When this Jubilee year, this Yovel year comes along, you are to make a proclamation. Literally, the word there in Hebrew is teruah, and that's a particular kind of a blast that, if you've heard the shofar very often, you know, there's teruah and tekiah and tekiah gadol and other kinds of things. But this says you're to make a teruah with the shofar. Gets translated as horn or trumpet into English usually. Sometimes people nowadays are beginning to understand what a shofar is enough, a ram's horn, that they leave it that way. And when does this happen? On the Day of Atonement, 10th day of the 7th month, make this proclamation throughout the land. I've heard some of the instruction that goes along with this portion saying, hey, we know that Israel got into trouble. Not just Israel, by the way, but all of Judah, both northern and southern kingdoms after the split. Because they were deciding, I don't think I want to let my folks go. You know, I need my farm hands. Not going to do that. The land, I don't think I have the trust anymore that's required to let it go fallow either. Not going to do that. Well, those things, among others, ended up in exile. Perhaps no surprise. At least for the time being, some have said, well, it makes it a little bit easier if you know everybody's doing it, if you're starting to get a little bit weak-kneed about doing what it is that he says, and all of a sudden people are hearing the shofar blast, oh, well, now at least everybody is aware of what ought to be going on. what's ought to be going on? Verse 10, you are to hallow, set apart that 50th year, and proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. Now, interestingly, that's the way it's translated. You know, it's on the Liberty Bell. Last I knew, that was in Philadelphia. I think it's still there anyway. It says this verse, proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. But it turns out it's really not throughout the land. It's Be'eretz, in the land, on the land. Is there a difference there? Well, kind of. There's a slight difference in the understanding, and I think this is another one of those places that, if you step back and look at it, kind of starts to resonate with us, particularly today, given that this was on the Liberty Bell, and if there's anything that seems not to apply anymore, it's liberty throughout a land that's increasingly looking fascist and totalitarian and like a police state and has turned its back on him in just about every way that it is possible to do so, and they're making up new ones all along the way. In the land, explicitly though, proclaim liberty, Be'eretz, in the land. And one of the things that you know, you can point out is that what happened during this Jubilee year is people returned to the land, to the ancestral home, to the inheritance of their fathers. Kind of like so that liberty overflows, Be'eretz, in the land. It's not maybe a big difference, but it's a distinction that when I think about the kinds of things that the Creator is implying to us here, if we'll really give it some thought, ought to show us that there really is something bigger in what He has laid out for us than even what we're reading. See a quick question on the screen? I'll just answer it. Who is Torah, and what are we talking about him for? I don't know if that's really considered to be tongue-in-cheek or not, but Torah literally is a word that gets mistranslated. It's not the way that the most English Bibles translate it. They'll say it's law. It's the law of Moses. Well, wrong. It's instruction. It's bigger than the law. And when our Creator means to say words that have legal implications, He does, like statutes and judgments and commandments in the Hebrew. So Torah is the whole package. Torah is His whole instruction for us. It's His written word, if you will. When it's capitalized, like it is on the screen right now, somebody has answered it, the Torah, HaTorah, usually means, not always, but usually means the specific instruction. Well, which one are we talking about? In that case, usually, they're talking about the five books of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, starting with Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, those five. But in the bigger sense, again, any time that you'll see the word instruction in the Bible, it's Torah. Here's my instruction for you. Keep my statutes, my judgments, and my commandments. So hopefully that's part of the answer. For those that are curious and coming into the room and saying, what are we hearing? Well, one of the things that I will try to point out, it's not unique with me. Others have come up with the name first. But I don't like the labels. Are you a Christian? Are you a Jew? Are you none of the above? Well, I like the term Torah observant believers. What are we trying to do? We're trying to walk out what it is that our Creator told us in His instruction, His Torah, to do. He didn't say it was ever done away with. He never nailed it to the cross. He never changed one yod or tittle. Yeshua Himself said that not one tiny bit, not one yod or tittle, not the smallest part was going to change so long as heaven and earth still existed. And, you know, like I said, last I checked, they still do. So it hasn't changed. He's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Malachi says the same thing. I change not. And if that's true, and it is, then we ought to listen to what He wrote for us and not be believing the lies of men who tell us, oh, no, that's all done away with. Don't pay any attention to that. Listen to what we say. Popes, Pharisees, priests, fathers, anybody else except the Creator and King of the universe. Can't trust Him. Well, it's one of the biggest lies in all of human history. And by the way, it dates all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, too. The end of this section, talking about the Yovel year, says, therefore, speaking of Torah, you shall do my statutes, hakotai, that's my statutes, and keep my ordinances and do them. And you shall dwell in the land in safety. And it really is about that simple. There's some more details in here about how things are supposed to work. And again, I'm not gonna dwell on those so much as just to step back and say, all right, think about the patterns. Look at the symbolism of this. Did I really say the word symbolism? Yeah. I'm going to spend more time talking about symbolism, maybe even things like conspiracy theory today too, than we sometimes do. Because ultimately the Bible is a book of patterns. It's about saying, look, here's the things that happened to the fathers. Are you surprised when they happen again to the sons? The cycle repeats. There are cycles within cycles and cycles of cycles. And ultimately there's nothing new under the sun because people haven't changed. Human nature remains the same. The heart of men are still desperately wicked. Who can know it? And so as a result, if you've seen it before, you'll probably see it again. If you recognize the pattern from last time, or in particular, if you can go back and see the pattern upon patterns, the big ones in Scripture, those too will repeat. And that's probably one of the things we're seeing laid out right now. So I'm talking about a number of things in that vein today, including the deceptions that can be associated with patterns. Because we can be semi-bright and see a part of the pattern, but miss the fact that the pattern can repeat. You know, as an engineer, I'll talk about sine waves. Well, the sine wave crosses through the zero point in both directions. Comes up, goes back down, then goes down the other way, just like a pendulum swinging through zero. We might recommend or recognize after a while that the pendulum is swinging, but it's important we understand which direction the pendulum is swinging to so that we know when things are going to reverse or when things are just going to speed up. So all of that's important. I see the question on the screen, too, about don't we mean God when we're talking about certain things. I don't have a big problem with those words. A lot of people coming out of Christianity or Judaism or the lies, Jeremiah 16:19 says that we've inherited from our fathers, will use those names or those titles more appropriately and not really realize what they mean. Because, for example, the name of the Creator, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, at least the four-letter tetragrammaton that represents his name, has been removed thousands and thousands of times, over 6,000 times, from Scripture. Isn't that interesting? And usually they'll replace it with capital L-O-R-D, but that's not really his name. It's not even close. And it might even be deliberately hiding. And I don't want to dwell on that so much as to say, it's like so many things in Scripture. If we'll go back and read what he originally wrote, we'll find that it's a whole lot different than the stuff we're being fed today. And that's essentially the bottom line. All right, so I'm talking about deceptions in that context. Let's start with a couple of things in the news and make a couple of points. This is not one that I was actually going to talk very much about, but it's probably how we'll lead off instead. And I saw people asking questions about it. It's been tweeted. It's been on the web. There was a picture. And as near as I can confirm, it actually came from the White House. And to my mind, that makes it kind of an in-your-face thing. Oh, yeah, aren't we clever? Aren't we funny? Ha ha. There's times that in the past that I've referred to the Clintonian truth.
You know, all depends on what the meaning of the word is.
Where you've got a lawyer literally telling you exactly the truth, and it's done in such a way that it leads you to exactly the wrong conclusion. And then later, that same person can say, I told you exactly what the truth was.
You just weren't listening carefully enough. If you don't parse it real, real careful, you're going to get the wrong idea.
And that's deliberate. So here we have the White House having released a picture of the emperor sitting on a throne. And it's a throne of feathers, and all of his little acolytes are gathered around him, kind of like the throne room of the Almighty, and he's got a crossbow sitting in front of him. And people are saying, isn't that amazing? Isn't that in your face? It is. It's symbolism saying, here he is. Here's your king. And not only that, others have pointed out, hey, it's a feathered throne. I think it's from the Game of Thrones. Honestly, I've never seen the TV or the movie or whatever the heck or the game that they're talking about, so I'm missing out on the wonderful cultural pagan implications here. But some are saying and pointing out that, well, all of it dates back, essentially, this feathered god to Quetzalcoatl. They made sacrifices to him. The symbolism, again, is in your face. It's another one of those things that tells us, well, whatever it is we're dealing with here, it sure as hell ain't the God of the Bible, and it's not anything that is in accord with his word or in worship. of him. In other words, it's something very different. So, when it comes to symbolism, the symbolism can be used to deceive as well. Last night we had a discussion for a couple minutes about advertising. Hey, how do people feel about advertising? And turns out, I can't argue with this, literally where it has gone is a lot like witchcraft. What's the essence of witchcraft? Well, it's to control. Whether it's by means of fear or whether you think it's a demonic thing specifically, and I'm not going to argue with any of those interpretations, the implication is somehow or other it's intended to deceive and to enslave and to control people in a way that they may not understand. And the essence of really, really good advertising is that it's so subtle people can be manipulated without their having a clue why it is that I want a Diet Coke. Yeah, let's tank down a little bit of aspartame poison, some neurotoxin. Well, isn't that wonderful? How great that science can get people to drink things that if they knew what was in them, they would say, hey, you got to be a fool to do that. I got one more story here along the same lines. This one I just throw out because it's interesting. I remember the MH370, the Malaysian Airlines flight. A story from Before It's News earlier this week said, the mother of all conspiracies this year, MH370, the missing nuclear materials, the grounding of planes. There were a whole lot of things that have come down in the last week or two. Planes were grounded in L.A. on, what day was that? I think it was Monday of this week. Turns out that there was a similar glitch that grounded all the planes in the U.K., on Tuesday, April 29th, the glitch in California was Wednesday, April 30th, very next day. And there's all kinds of other stuff that the conspiracy theorists are pointing out. This is just plain weird. What's going on here? Could it be there's a false flag being set up? Well, very well may be. I guess eventually we'll probably know, but we may not hear about it in time to do anything good. Supposedly, the glitch in L.A. had to do with a U-2 spy plane. And I'll admit, when I heard that story, some of you know I'm a pilot, been flying general aviation airplanes for a quarter century at this point, and it stank to high heaven. What? Come on. Air traffic controllers can't tell when a plane at 60,000 feet is the problem, and controllers even practice for radar outages and so forth. Not to say that given the control mentality coming out of Washington nowadays that they wouldn't try to do this, but the point is it's not a real technical reason for shutting down all the air traffic in a major part of the United States. It might be an excuse for something else. Does that mean that's what it is? Is that what I'm saying? No. I'm just saying that when I see it as a pilot, there are certain things that I go, something about, there's something rotten in Denmark here. This doesn't wash. It's a little bit like the White House releasing a picture of the emperor sitting on a throne. Is it funny? Yeah, it is if you don't understand. But is it maybe just an in-your-face little bit of witchcraft conditioning you to the fact that, see, whether you like it or not, you've got a king? That Liberty Bill thing, proclaim liberty throughout the land? Not anymore. We're watching. We're listening. Saw a story that irritated me overnight. I don't think it was sometime in the last 24 hours anyway, fairly recently. John McCain, the other man who would be king, arguably, kind of a Hobson's choice a few years back. And he basically is saying, hey, so you're being monitored. Yeah, get used to it. We're listening. Yeah, get used to it. It's just life nowadays. Well, it's not what it was supposed to be. And all you lying, cheating cretins and liars and criminals and basically people who are committing treason, let's call it what it is, that put your hand on the Bible and swore an oath to defend the rule of law and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, all these things that you have absolutely no intention of doing. There's a problem here. We recognize it. Is witchcraft? Is it advertising? Sure. We have committed a police state, and we've put it in place right before your very eyes. You're not supposed to have a king, but you got one anyway. We can kill you with drones. We can do all these things. Supreme Court, last week, as you know, essentially said, when it comes to NDAA and the ability to literally disappear people, just like in Soviet Russia, never to be seen again, well, we can do that nowadays, too. We don't need any rule of law. We can indefinitely detain you journalists, and that was the case. They simply refused to even hear it. Now, the funny thing is they said, y'all don't have standing. What does standing mean? Well, it means we haven't arrested you and taken you away and thrown you in a dark dungeon somewhere yet. Now, once we decide to do that, then you might have standing. But here's the catch-22. Then you won't be able to get to a lawyer or have your day in court or have the evidence presented against you or know the charges or anything else anyway. We don't even have to have evidence. Ha, ha, ha. It's the essence of a lawless state. If we're looking for more and more indications of the symbolism of empire and of having moved beyond a rule of law to where we are a nation of men and not of law, then those things are clear. This week we had a couple other examples. You got Obama at a Cinco de Mayo reception saying essentially, hey, let's push to get rid of the kind of citizenship that people think is important. Now that too turns out to have been a lie. But he essentially said something that I thought was really irritating. He said, America's prosperity and security depend on comprehensive common sense immigration reform. Oh, really? Well, there would have been a time when some of us would have thought that it depended on leaders obeying their oaths before God and upholding the rule of law. Well, I guess that's not true anymore. We're upending that. And to my mind, the thing that was so, you know, in your face about this was we don't see the emperor on the 4th of July, Independence Day of the United States, saying, you know, what's important to America's prosperity and security is that we understand that there are certain self-evident truths, that your rights do not come from us, they come from God. We're not hearing that at all. It's another backwards message. And, of course, then to top it all off, we got this, the Secretary of State this week, after some emails came out that indicated that, yes, there was treason in Benghazi, that people who, the ambassador and some people that had pledged their lives to defend that area there and that those personnel were literally hung out to dry. It's the essence of treason. The emails have come out. Congress says we want to investigate, and the Secretary of State says, you're going to subpoena me? How dare you? I'm above the rule of law. I'm above the law. Go pound salt. Literally. Secretary of State says, Congress? Ha! I scoff at your so-called subpoena. I ain't coming. I got a trip to Mexico. I guess I'm going to go down there and talk about Cinco de Mayo. Can we have any doubt anymore about exactly how far gone certain things have become? What I want to do at this point is pause for a second, because we're going to talk some more about some of the other things in the news, and I'm going to talk in specific about some of the things that we can see and need to be understanding because of the times that we're in. Usual reminder, we're told in Scripture, Chronicles, be like the men of Issachar, because they knew the times and the seasons, so they knew what Israel should do. We're too supposed to know the times and the seasons and have an understanding of what's going on around us. We're not supposed to be ignorant so that, you know, something bad could come upon us like a thief in the night, if you want to use that metaphor. We're supposed to know. We're supposed to be awake and aware. Here's the verse. This is one you've heard me talk about before. But if it's not clear, I guess by now it's one of my favorites. Not because it's a, not because it's something that I am happy about that is true, but it's certainly something that is important as a warning that is true. I mean, if I was to pick favorite verses, it'd be things like Deuteronomy 30. I've laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing, so choose life. That's a wonderful, uplifting, and clearly indicative choice. It's back to this Liberty Bell thing. Hey, he's given us life. He's given us liberty and tells us it's an open book test. Choose. Walk on a daily basis to choose life. Well, when people don't do that, then we have this warning from Isaiah. And it's, if you're curious, want to look it up, just remember it's the very, very last chapter in Isaiah's set of prophecies, chapter 66. You don't even have to know the number. Just turn to the end of the book and go back a little bit. It's talking about, thus says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, heaven's my throne, earth is my footstool. Here are some things that are important. On this one I will look, one who is poor and of a contrite spirit, who trembles at my word. May that include us. On the other hand, you've got the counterpoint here, which has to do with people that are offering bogus sacrifices, ultimately. And then you got to wonder, who are they offering them to? And the implication, and by the way, the rest of the Scripture is clear, if they're not the things that the Creator says do because I've asked you to, don't do these other things because the pagans do them, and that's what's getting done. Well, now we got a problem. Because, as he puts it here in verse 3, in verse 4, just as these folks who do that kind of stuff have chosen their own ways, and their soul delights in their abominations. Now, focus on that verse over and over again, because as we go through the news, I want you to think about that. They have chosen their own ways. Hey, we got American Idol today. We got our TV show. We got our own witchcraft advertising. We're telling you what's happening. Even if you don't recognize it, we're telegraphing our moves, and you're either with us or you're with that God of the Bible who's not welcome in our schools anyway, and we're going to ostracize you if you think something different than what we think. Their soul delights in their abominations. Okay, got it. So, what's going to happen? Here's the real key. So I, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, will choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. Your fear of terrorism? Check. Your fear of, you name it. Global warming. Well, it might not be global warming. It might be something that you don't have a clue yet, but similar concept. I'm going to choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them, he says. Because when I called, no one answered. When I spoke, they did not hear. But instead, they did evil before my eyes, and they chose that in which I do not delight. So back to the real point. What are some other things that we can see in the news that would give us a clue as to whether people and whether a society, and by the way, I don't necessarily mean just the United States. I'm talking about the whole Western world, if you will, and indeed just the whole world in general, because ultimately nothing's changed. Still, we're talking about a set of kingdoms of the world that does not, on the whole, even acknowledge the creator of the universe. They worship another god, or gods many. I asked this question before, let me ask it again today. If I said the word Boko Haram, and that's not Procol Harum for those of you that are a few decades old, that's Boko Haram. Give me a 1 if you know what it is that I'm talking about, a 2 if you don't. And I'm curious as the answer. Well, this is going to take a few seconds. 1 if you've heard the term Boko Haram, if you know what I'm talking about, 2 if you don't. And give me a 2 if you're not sure if you've heard it and you don't remember. Maybe it's whiter shade of pale and you're not 100% sure. Okay, today we got almost all 1s so far. I know the 2s always take a little bit longer to come up. So we got some 2s finally coming in. And it's now approaching half and half. Well, let's go through this quickly. The big story, the story that the waste stream was focused on, was the fact that there's some 200 schoolgirls, and now it's actually a little bit higher than that, that have been abducted by this group. Now, what you don't as often hear is that this was an Islamic terrorist group, and they have been abducting schoolgirls largely from Christian schools. That, too, doesn't get a whole lot of press. Because these folks don't like anybody, especially girls, being educated in anything that is not Islam. But there's more to it. And I guess what kind of bugs me about it is the waste stream focus and the fact that the stories that I saw involve people saying, oh, it's all about education and it's all about how they hate girls and women. And while there's an element of truth in that, there always is, that's the 80-20 rule, there's something bigger than this that the media is ignoring. It's a cultural clash, yes. And in particular, it's a specific kind of terrorism that's politically incorrect. It's worse than that. I'll come back to that in a second. But there was an attack earlier this week after they had kidnapped the couple hundred girls and told the world, we're going to sell them into sex slavery. They tore up a town. A town of about 3,000 people in Nigeria called Gamburu Nigala, where dozens of militants wearing fatigues, wielding AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenade launchers. Isn't it interesting? They're very well armed. Unlike the people of the land that they ran roughshod through, who have been completely disarmed. You know, they don't have a right from God to keep and bear arms in most of the rest of the world. And indeed, that's becoming the situation all over the place. Well, they couldn't do anything about it. So these Islamic terrorists rode through the town with their AK-47s and RPGs and chanting Allahu Akbar, firing indiscriminately, killing hundreds of people and torching houses. When it was all over, at least 336 people had been killed. Hundreds of houses and cars had been set on fire, but it was the schoolgirls that have grabbed the world's attention. There's no security in the area. It turns out one of the things that happened, of course, is what little bit of security the town had, the Nigerian military and some of those people that were volunteering to help try to keep the town safe were all hauled away looking for the girls. Because now, at least this is the story, because the worldwide press had finally heard about this thing that's been going on for a long time. Not until they've been killing people. But not until they kidnapped the 200 schoolgirls did the worldwide press say that it was worth talking about. The local senator said there's no presence of security men in that area, and the militants are, quote, having a field day. Now, the thing that was also interesting to me about this is how the press treated it. And I had a story from the New York Times editorialist essentially pointing out, look, what we need to do is we need to make donations to this this wonderful fund that's going to it's called something like Educating Children in Africa or Women's Education in Africa. $40, a donation of $40. Maybe they'll give you a ribbon. I guess you can wear too. Ribbons are wonderful, and that will buy a uniform for a schoolgirl. Well, that'll fix the problem. And as another columnist that I enjoy, Vox Day had pointed out, they have turned these young girls into legitimate military targets, whether people like to admit it or not, by turning them into weapons in the culture war. So these folks aren't stupid. They know how it is that they can achieve the maximum visibility. So the more they set these young girls up to be pawns, the more they're going to attack them. Put them in nice uniforms so they're easy to identify, so much the better. Maybe people should instead be given money to say, hey, you know, we could buy these men in the village some arms so that they could defend the girls. Now, the funny thing was, the New York Times editorialist even pointed out, well, there were 50 of the girls that had escaped, and their fathers had followed them into the jungle, going up against these RPG and AK-47 armed terrorists who'd been tearing up towns with nothing but bows and arrows. And that ought to tell you something about what fathers will do for their daughters when the time comes. Imagine if they had $40 worth of uniforms instead in the way of weaponry to prevent that kind of thing in the beginning. Point here really is that the thing that the media is focused on is not necessarily the important aspect of the whole story. And that kind of bugs me a little bit. Here now comes the news that came out on Friday. Hasn't made the waste stream much at all. Comes from the Washington Examiner and places like the Daily Beast. And it says this, in spite of the public posturing, Hillary Clinton was among those quoted this week. Oh, it's so awful. What an abomination that these young schoolgirls have been abducted. But the report goes like this. The State Department under Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, fought hard against putting this Al-Qaeda-linked militant group, Boko Haram, Islamic terrorists, mind you, on the official list of foreign, see, you're so used to hearing domestic terrorists, because that's the only kind that really matter. It's those people that have constitutions and believe in the Bible. They're the real terrorists. No, these guys are the real terrorists, but the State Department ignored and denied it and literally wouldn't even put them on the list that they're using to persecute others for. And now the officials in the U.S. are finally admitting the decision may have hurt the American ability to confront this Nigerian terror group that shocked the world with the abduction. Clinton said, calling the latest act abominable, criminal, and an act of terrorism. And it merits the fullest response, yada, yada, yada. She went on to say that when she was Secretary of State, she had numerous meetings with the Nigerian president. what she didn't mention, the story says, those at her own State Department refused to place Boko Haram on the list of foreign terror organizations back in 2011. They fought it for 2 years. And that was after the same group had already bombed UN headquarters in Abuja. And it came despite the urging of their own Department of Justice, us, and the FBI and the CIA and over a dozen senators and congressmen. You can't make this stuff up. They're a lot more focused, in other words, on fighting the real terrorists. What's the real terrorists? Well, the real terrorists, as you've no doubt heard, are racists and people, again, that believe they have rights from God, a different God than the one that Washington wants to worship now. They're talking about Cliven Bundy. The FBI has now said they're investigating him and those people who came to his defense. Why? Well, because, see, this week we had a 93-year-old woman in Austin who had a gun outside of her own home. She was killed by a cop. Shot her dead. 93-year-old woman had a gun. Well, peons aren't supposed to have guns. If a cop sees a peon with a gun, doesn't have a badge, they're likely to get killed. That's what happened to her. In New York this week, there was a 25-year-old co-ed who was found guilty of a felony. She's doing 2 to 7 in the state pen because when somebody came up behind her at an Occupy Wall Street thing a couple of years ago, she elbowed this person thinking she was being groped or abducted or accosted in some fashion. Well, the accoster turned out to be a policeman, a New York PD. Well, that is verboten. How dare you elbow a cop? That's a felony. She's doing 2 to 7. Here's what the FBI is really upset with the Bundy family and those who came to their defense. Because some of the people who came may have had weapons, and they may have pointed weapons at federal officers. That is a crime. Now, you can kill somebody. You can kill a mundane. You can kill a peon. You can gun down a 93-year-old woman in Austin. You can send the criminals who dare to elbow a cop to prison. But don't you dare think, even by accident, that you can point a weapon at a federal officer, at one of your betters. You heard me quote this line because it seems so appropriate of late. You will have one law, says the Torah, for you and the stranger who dwells among you. Well, that's obviously in the land, not in this land, because we don't have one law. We don't even have any law. We've just been told by the Supreme Court that as far as the new government in the United States is concerned, peons don't have rights. They don't have right to due process. They sure as hell don't have a right to keep and bear arms or to freedom of worship or assembly. Now, if you're going to worship another god than us, than the one that sits on the feathered throne, and they had better not even think about pointing a weapon at somebody, even if they're planning on killing them. Something is horribly wrong, and the rule of law is at least one of the harbingers, one of the clear symbols, right? Forget the Liberty Bell. We got something else entirely going on today. Another case in point, right to farm. This one has been going on for a long time. Mike Adams and several other people picked up on the theme this week because there was another new development in Michigan where small farmers, I don't care for the animals so far as food is concerned, but I can relate to this individual. Michigan is a state where not long ago the Department of Natural Resources ordered a small local pig farmer to shoot all of his pigs, not because they were diseased, but because they were the wrong race of pigs. They were some kind of a hybrid pig that they didn't think this small farmer should have. And there was another case in Michigan where Julie Bass, an Oak Park woman, was threatened with jail time for daring to teach her children how to grow vegetables in their own home garden. They only backed down when she went to the local press and basically shamed them into it. This week, essentially, the state of Michigan has ruled that local governments, cities, towns, counties, can ban any animal they wish from small residential farms. And the move opens the door for any municipality to literally criminalize backyard farms and small residential farming operations where people might want to keep a few goats or chickens or honeybees for food security. The ruling says they could literally ban all of that stuff if there's any other property or home within 250 feet in any direction. which is, again, that's going to take care of most backyard gardens and small chicken operations. You know, this kind of stuff, when you put it all together, the symbolism is hard to deny, if nothing else. I talk a lot about the economics. I'm going to set this story aside for a while. We'll come back to it, why it is that we can see this going on. We know that it has to do with dishonest weights and measures, I think, at this point. But I want to talk about some of the other aspects of this. Similarly, there are stories this week about the FCC and the FEC, Federal Election Commission, now getting into the act and saying we need to be able to shut down the web, and we need to be able to say that politically incorrect groups, you know, things like this one, or Drudge Report specifically was named, and a few others, cannot be allowed to speak things that the almighty state doesn't want them to say. Any questions or comments so far? I wasn't watching as closely as I perhaps should have. Give it a second. Okay, I don't think I've seen anything. If there are any from the other room, if somebody would be so kind as to pop those over, because I can't look at both rooms online here while we're doing this. I want to talk about some specifics. Again, where do we go? What does all of this say about where we are today, and in particular with respect to things that we're seeing in this week's Torah portion, this idea of faith? Lots and lots of things that we don't think they apply anyway. We're not in the land. We got these patterns of sevens. We've been told that his feasts don't matter anymore. And certainly we know that there's not about to be a time in the United States where the slaves are going to be freed. No, not the real slaves. I'm not talking about the slaves that were supposedly freed in 1865 or a little bit before that as part of the posturing that led up to it. No, I'm talking about the slaves that, whether they know it or not, cannot own property, cannot defend themselves, cannot buy a gun, or indeed pretty soon anything without having some kind of mark of permission. You've heard me say this as well. If you cannot buy the one piece of property in the United States, or indeed anywhere in the world, because the United States was pretty well the last holdout, if you can't go down and buy the one kind of property that the Bill of Rights said specifically, the only property in the United States in the Constitution that was mentioned this way, singled out this way, a firearm, if you can't buy that without a background check or permission from Big Brother, then what the heck can you buy or sell? If they can prohibit that one kind of property that was specifically enumerated as shall not be infringed, you're a slave. You don't have any rights to anything. If they can take away Clive and Bundy's 160-year-old right to graze his cattle on land that long, long predates not only the founding of the United States, but certainly the Bureau of Land Management's claim to tax and fold and spindle things, what can't they take away? People think they own their property. You don't. Let's not kid ourselves. If you don't pay the rent on it, sometimes it's called property taxes to deceive the innocent. If you don't pay the rent, the real owner will come with guns that you aren't allowed to have. And by the way, you're not allowed to point a weapon at those criminals either. They'll call that a felony. You can't even elbow them if they're trying to grope your wife. You certainly can't elbow them if they're at an airport wanting to take naked pictures of your 4-year-old. Are you a free person or are you a slave? Is the Liberty Bell literally a joke now sitting there? I'm thinking the answer is all of the above. So where are we at? What do we do? I change gears, but just for a second, see if this makes sense. You've heard me talk before about this idea of conspiracy theory, and the old saying that I like is, never ascribe to conspiracy that which can be explained by stupidity. And lately I've been having to ask the question, come on. We see so many things that Washington is doing, whether it's attempting to foist a war on the world. First it was in Syria. Well, first it was a whole bunch of things before Syria. But Syria not too long ago. Now it's in the Ukraine. They overthrew a government in the Ukraine, tried to torque off Russia. Russia launched some ICBMs this week saying, hey, we don't play the sanctions game. We're not going to respond with sanctions. We're not going to tell you what we're going to respond, but it's going to be something different. But maybe you can take a hint from this military exercise where they launched a couple of ICBMs. Same week, the Senate comes out, some hearings in Capitol Hill telling us what we've already heard before, if we've been paying attention. attention, and that is if there's an EMP event, if there's a nuclear war, if there's a solar event, if there's a cyber attack on the U.S. power grid, 90%, their estimates, 90% of the American populace will be dead within months. Massive die-offs. It's not surprising if you understand the interconnection, the fact that when the power grid goes down, so does the gasoline and diesel grid. So do the credit card schemes and the payments that are required to keep the whole, you know, deck of cards not all over the floor. What happens? Well, within hours after things go down like that, the food shelves start to empty. The trucks that would replenish the food shelves find that if they can't get gas, and if they can't pay for the gas or the diesel, and if the roads are blocked with other vehicles that are out of fuel anyway, they can't deliver stuff. Well, then what happens? Well, the people that don't have food, they don't show up for work. So the power grid doesn't get fixed, and things just spiral rapidly downhill. How do most people die? They die of dysentery, because they can't flush their toilets, and they don't have clean water, and they're living in a city of millions where they can't escape, and they don't have food, and they don't have water, and then what happens next, folks? Answer? Well, the veneer of civilization is very thin. Cannibalism and rampant disease. Things get very, very ugly with a speed that most people can't imagine. Does that mean that's going to happen? Not necessarily. But I started this by saying, can people be this stupid? Never ascribe to conspiracy that which can be explained by stupidity. Well, let me give you another example, one of my favorites. Anthropogenic global warming, AGW. Man-made global warming. Well, since global warming is now clearly revealed to be a bald-faced lie, they've changed the name. They call it man-made. Oops, no, we dropped the man-made part too, but it's implied. That's part of the advertising witchcraft. Climate change. What can fix it? Well, no God of the Bible can fix it. The only thing that can fix it is the God of the United Nations and the God of Al Gore and the God of the carbon trading scheme. Hey, it's worth trillions to us, but don't even pay any attention to that man behind the curtain. Just know that we have to put in place the Kyoto protocols, and we've got to curtail your right to be able to drive an SUV or heat your house as the winters get colder, in spite of the lie we're telling. Be afraid, be very afraid, in other words, of something that is positively BS, is not going to happen. Meanwhile, if the power grid goes down, 90% of you are going to be dead within months. Are we going to talk about that? Not like we do global climate change. Not like we do the need to get rid of your right to keep and bear arms. Not like we do the need to be afraid, be very afraid of sovereign citizens and people that have Bibles and constitutions. Now, forget Boko Haram. Well, unless they do something politically incorrect. Now we'll talk about them 2 years after we could have but didn't put them on a terror list. Can you see how stupid this is? Focusing on the wrong thing, trying to get people all afraid of something that is absolute BS while they're ignoring threats that really, truly might kill tens or hundreds of millions of people. I get to the point where I say, okay, no, come on, let's not kid ourselves. Nobody could be that stupid. Seriously, these are not stupid people. These are evil people. These are people that, whether we like to admit it or not, have to be doing this for a whole different reason. Well, maybe a few trillion dollars of carbon tax credits and transfers, that might serve as a reason. If the Supreme Court can be bought or blackmailed by the NSA, and we've seen evidence that they have been, Obamacare comes to mind. If it turns out that they won't even hear cases about the peons getting hauled away and locked up in a dungeon forevermore, could there be another agenda at work here? Could it be that as the dollar collapses and the scam of the manipulation and of the gold and silver market, crooked casino controls, all of that stuff is beginning to come out, and it is? Could it be that there's a need to just kind of rush things and push people? Maybe so. So I started this thought process by remembering a book that I'd read. Some of you, I'm sure, have read it. It's a good book. It has a glaring flaw, unfortunately. It's by Ayn Rand, who, as it turns out, the flaw kind of tells you she was an atheist. So she didn't acknowledge that there was a creator. That was a blind spot. Other than that, the book is very good. It's just that it would have been a heck of a lot better had she recognized the history of the United States and of, indeed, most of the people that were involved in putting the good stuff in the law in place, that we have rights that come from God, not from any man. But what I did like about the book was the way it was laid out. The theme, if you haven't read it, is that there's a whole bunch of titans of industry. The people, the John Galt's, who is John Galt? The John Galt's of the world, and the Hank Reardon's of the world, who had great big steel companies and massive railroad companies, and they were entrepreneurs. They were the movers and the shakers. They built the great cities and the railroads and the things that made America industrially strong. And they eventually decided, as the world got more and more socialized, I'm just not going to play. Going to go on strike. Heck with you. They were going to come out of her. That part, as you might guess, I really liked. And they went to this place. It became called Galt's Gulch. I like the fact that it was in Colorado. Kind of funny, too. But what I, at the time, thought was kind of funny about the book was the bad guys. I can't think of the one bad guy's name. James Talbert? Taggart. James Taggart was the antagonist in the book, and he was basically a socialist. And the guy was such a fruitcake idiot. That was what it seemed like. Nobody could be that stupid. And people were listening to these people, and they were doing such stupid things. And she showed how the society kept passing these draconian rules that destroyed industry and undermined everything that had built the society. And I thought, come on, could America really be that stupid? Could people really be drinking that kind of Kool-Aid? You give me, and then I look back at it and I go, come on, it was brilliant. As stupid as I thought all that stuff was, caricatures, literally. Her characters seemed like caricatures because they just were so transparently stupid. And I look and I think, none of these people were as stupid, at least on paper, as anybody that's working in Washington today. And I see the comment on the screen, actually Taggart was very evil. You're right. Of course they were. Because they couldn't have been that stupid. That's my point. They were truly evil. Now, people that believed them, I guess, can be said to be stupid. Well, wait a minute. Time out, Mark. Let's go back to where I started today. Let me read this for you and see if this makes a little bit more sense now. Are people in America really as stupid as they would seem to be buying into the same kind of lie that the people in Nazi Germany bought into? Seriously, I'm not kidding you. I have seen this for years and believed exactly. United States is treading the precise path of Nazi Germany. We've got the enabling acts. We've got the various things. The only thing we haven't had yet, at least in your face, is Kristallnacht. We did have Waco. We had Oklahoma City. We had the shoot down of TWA 800. We've got a bunch of other things happening. We may have the Bundy situation playing out before our eyes today, all of which is real similar. But could people really be as stupid in America as they were in Nazi Germany? And before that, as stupid as Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote about during the Soviet pogroms, the Stalin era, and before? Could they? Or maybe there's something else going on here. Maybe it's this. Just as they have chosen their own ways and their soul delights in their abominations, in their American idols, their worship of any other god except the God of the Bible, they're having turned from the things he says to do and doing something different. Yeah, just as their soul delights in their abominations, so will I choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. You know, folks, if I was doing a court case, I would say the prosecution rests at this point. I will suggest the evidence is so overwhelming, so undeniable. It cannot be anything else. People could not possibly be this stupid otherwise unless the King and Creator of the universe and author of Scripture is choosing their delusions and bringing their fears upon them. You afraid of terrorism? Oh, I'll show you terrorism. It's not going to be the terror you think. It's coming from a beast government that I'm going to put in place. And you're going to vote for it. And by the way, whether it's a McCain or an Obama, doesn't really matter, because they're both serving the same master. They both appear to be absolutely, positively stupid, but they're not stupid. They're truly just evil and deceived. And if you can't figure it out yet, they're not worshiping me. They put their hand on a Bible, but their fruit makes it real clear who they're serving. Debauchery is their end. If you notice, I'm reading the comment from Simpkins on screen about, I believe Yah has closed their eyes and blinded them. Stiff-necked people. We go through Torah. If you'll note, and I'll pray this way today as I always try to remember to do. Eyes to see and ears to hear. It's a metaphor. It's a way of phrasing. A narrow path, veer not to the right or to the left. There are certain phrases that show up over and over and over and over again in Scripture because they're so apropos. People that don't have eyes to see or ears to hear. We can pray. If we will ask Him, and by the way, if we will turn to Teshuva to Him, He has said He will do those things. There's even a line where he says, I think it's in one of the prophets, and I'll have to get the whole verse to come to mind. But, had they asked, I would have healed them, but they wouldn't. I would have had to heal them. In other words, if we'll learn to ask, He'll open our eyes. He'll give us ears to hear. He'll heal us. But we got to ask. If we're too stiff-necked to ask, too unwilling to turn, and even acknowledge that He is who He says He is, then we got far bigger problems. It's not going to happen. And ultimately, that's where we're at. It's kind of a catch-22. I will choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. Once people get driven by fear and nothing else, you know what happens. They're dead. It's the essence of panic. I've talked before, too, about being a pilot and a scuba diver. You want to get killed flying or scuba diving? Forget your training. Forget the instruction. If something bad happens, all you got to do, 99 times out of 100, is remember the instruction, keep your head, and think. And do the things that you've been trying to do. Deal with the emergency the way you've practiced it. But if you panic, you're dead. Why am I spending the time talking about this today? Because that's the message, folks. If you panic, you're dead. If you let your fears drive you, there are going to be people that will die. If we fail to walk in the kind of faith that says, you know what, if He says in the seventh year, we're to let the land have its Sabbath, and we don't, we're not walking in faith. Learn those things. A couple quick stories, and then we'll go into where I'm really headed. Gangster State America, this piece by Paul Craig Roberts came out a couple days ago. The Constitution has been set aside, he says. The executive branch has degenerated into Caesarism. I like that expression. There were a couple professors that wrote a paper this week. Some people have heard it talked about, saying that the United States is now an oligarchy. It was never a democracy, never supposed to be a democracy. Let's not kid ourselves. The founders knew that was the devil's own government. By the way, as you've heard me say, Scripture points it out too. There's no place in Scripture, not one that I've ever seen, where the majority voted and outvoted God and was anything except punished horribly for the mistake. Professor Martin Gillens, Princeton, and Professor Benjamin Page of Northwestern have examined American governments and concluded, surprise, surprise, the U.S. is an oligarchy ruled by rich, powerful private interest groups, and that there's only a superficial resemblance to a democracy, which wasn't supposed to have been the form of government anyway. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, note that a republic is not at all the same thing. Democracy is where 51% of the people have the right to take, buy, vote, the property and the lives and the liberty of the other 49%. As Ben Franklin so appropriately put it, democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner. Well, now we're at oligarchy. And here's some things from their conclusions, he says, that are striking and they're kind of cute. The central point emerging from our research is that the economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass-based groups of citizens and average citizens have little or no influence. Okay, that's a little bit verbose, but here's a better way to put it. In the United States, our findings indicate the majority does not rule, at least not in the causal sense of actually determining policy outcomes. Now, here's the real whopper of the piece. Quote, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, and statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. In other words, folks, they're telling you what the truth has been for a long time. Your vote, your influence, your writing your senator, your congressman, your editorial position in the paper doesn't mean squat. The emperor serves another god. He's going to do what his god commands him to do, and your god and your opinion got nothing whatsoever to do with it. And they're just basically saying we've determined this mathematically. There's some reasons for all of this. I'm going to skip the reasons, but the conclusions do kind of make some interesting points here. Offshoring U.S. jobs has had an impact as manufacturing and industrial unions have declined in influence. It's now obvious that the traditional backbone of the Democrat Party's financial support has gone away. So now they appeal to the same interest groups as the Republican parties. Basically, it's Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, and the industries that they claim to find despoiling the environment. Because all of the parties, both wings, as I like to put it, of that same bird of prey, are now financed by the same private interests, they serve the same masters. And you can look at the Bush regime and the Clinton regime before that and see that they're doing the same thing, literally, that the Obama regime's been doing. It's just that Obama's doing it more. And having stood on the shoulders of those giants, he's pushing the envelope a bit further. Recently, the Supreme Court even ruled that it is merely an exercise of free speech for oligarchs to purchase the U.S. government. The corrupt court invented a constitutional right. Now, you don't have a right to keep and bear arms, mind you, or to be free of illegal search and seizure. But the federally licensed corporations have a constitutional right to use their vast financial resources to form a government of their choosing. So what we have is a gangster state. Makes the old Russian Empire under Stalin look kind of tame by comparison. And he says, nowadays, the Russian government, this is now Paul Craig Roberts speaking, has curtailed the activities of some of their oligarchs who used the privatization claims to support control of resources, but the government's actions are at least over there consistent with the rule of law. In the United States, they're not even trying to feign obedience to the rule of law. You got all kinds of examples. Regulators sell protection from law, because they're going to get well-paying jobs with the very industries that they were supposed to regulate. Look at what's happened with the CFTC and the silver and gold manipulation. Look what happens with the FDA, the Department of Agriculture, you name it. Monsanto rules the roost. The Supreme Court not only permits money to purchase the government, but sells out the Constitution to the police state. Again, we got NDAA this week. It's unambiguous that what it was unconstitutional. What does the Supreme Court say? Hear no evil, see no evil, ignore all evil. And finally now, the gangster state is criminalizing dissent and truth tellers. He mentions Julian Assange, Ed Snowden. They'd like to kill those folks if they could find them. And ultimately, where we come to is this. In the 20th century, or 21st century, it's difficult to find a significant single statement coming from Washington that is not an outright lie. You like your doctor? You like your insurance policy? You can keep them. Obamacare's a lie. Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction was a lie. Assad's use of chemical weapons in Syria was a lie. Iranian nukes, a lie. Russian aggression against Georgia, a lie. 9-1-1, the basis for the Patriot Act and the destruction of constitutional and other rights all across the nation, is itself a lie. The job statistics that come out every week are a lie. The inflation statistics, a lie. And as I've already mentioned, anthropogenic global warming, for which the solution is Big Brother's carbon credits, all of it is a lie. And of course, mother of all of them, the almighty dollar, it's a lie. No resemblance to honest weights and measures. Now, here's the place I've been building up to. Back to this question of stupidity. Choosing their delusions. Washington, he says, has no respect for the intelligence of the American people. And no respect for the integrity, ha-ha, of the American media. Think about that. Washington has no respect for the intelligence of the American people. The stupidity is so in your face that they can come out with a symbolism of a president, now an emperor, sitting on a throne made of feathers, symbolizing pagan gods, with a crossbow sitting in front of him. Hey, who's allowed to have a weapon in the presence of the president? Nobody. But he can have a crossbow, and he's going to rub it in your face. You point a gun at any federal agent, you pee on you. It's a federal crime. And here you thought there was a time when the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, or that you had a right to be free of illegal search and seizure, not at airports. And neither presidential candidate McCain from years back or Obama is going to tell you anything else other than, hey, you live in America, get used to it. Big Brother is watching you. The conclusion is inescapable. He says U.S. is a gangster state. Worse than that, it's a shameless tyranny. Again, because it's in your face. Because it's undeniable. From there, we go to this piece. This is starting to really... let's do this one quickly, too. Some of you have heard me talk about the clergy response team. Clergy response team. This is a FEMA thing. It's an IRS-enabled thing. If you've got a 501c3 Caesar-created faith-based state-chartered corporate religious entity, a.k.a. a licensed church. Well, when Caesar says jump, that church says how high? When Caesar says teach them what Romans 13 says, oh, that's it. Well, when Caesar says jump, you say how high? Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, unto Yod Heh Vav Heh that which is his. Whose are you? Answer, if you've got the state's license, if you've got the state's marriage, if you've got any of the state's bennies, you belong to Caesar. Slaves? Freed at the end of 7 years? Or at the Jubilee? Hardly. Not anymore. You've signed up to serve another master. So we got this from Hanover County, Virginia, where the sheriff has rolled out a surveillance and snitch program for local churches. It's called the Worship Watch, and I'm not kidding. The mission of the program, according to a post on the Hanover County Sheriff webpage, is to reduce crime and fear of crime in houses of worship and provide the faith community with all kinds of preparedness, partnership initiatives. Yes, you can join with the beast. And, of course, if your pastor doesn't want to join with the beast, call us. Let us know. We can maybe persuade them. Okay. Where I'm headed, of course, is what do we do about it, right? If we begin to, we start saying, okay, know who we serve. Talk about that frequently. Come out of her. Understand that clearly the symbolism of what Scripture tells us and the symbolism of what we're seeing literally having our faces and our noses rubbed in says that there's a whole different set of gods at play here. There's no way anybody can go to Washington, D.C. today, look at the gods in the rotunda of the Capitol, see the Roman architecture and all of the Roman civil law things, and not understand. It's something very, very, very different from what we thought or were told at least decades ago that the rule of law in the United States was supposed to be about, and that rights come from God, and that God is the one that was written about in Scripture. Oh, we've been told for so long we start to believe it, that Jefferson was a deist, bull, and that Washington and all those others were Masons. Well, tell you what, folks, Masonry, just like the Constitution, ain't what it used to be. Things do change over time. The meaning of words changes over time. And the creator of the universe and his word doesn't. That's the difference. So once we see this, once we start saying, okay, if I'm going to try to serve Yod Heh Vav Heh and him alone, if I want to come out, I'm going to begin to teshuva, to turn. Turning is a process. It's not like all of a sudden, if I've been blinded, I can just make a complete 180 and then expect to still be blind and walk the path perfectly in the opposite direction, right? There's a process of saying, okay, Father, guide me. Help me. Give me eyes to see and ears to hear. Help me turn around. Help me to realize the mistakes that I've been making and start getting things right. Help me to start keeping your feasts, your statutes, and your judgments and commandments. Teach me your ways, O Yah, that I might walk in them. Let your Torah be a lamp to my feet. Uh, I see a comment on the screen. I'm not sure if I understand the question, Brekia, about the gangster, if there is a question there. But it says Hitler was seen as a hero in the beginning. You know what, folks? There were a lot of people that saw Hitler as a hero for a long, long time. This may surprise you, but I think there are still folks in the United States that see Obama as a hero. Or, you know, pick a president. You got your R-types and your D-types, and they'll see no evil in the guy that they idolize as being godlike. That hasn't changed, because most people are still blinded. He's still choosing their delusions. And those that fell for Hitler, or those that fell for Obama, or those that fell for Bush, are still fallen. They're still going to idolize those people. And as I named all of those names deliberately, somebody's going to react to one of them and say, oh, well, that offended me. He put my guy in there with those other guys. Well, you know what, folks? There's a line that I kind of like, and it, let God be true, let Elohim be true, and every man a liar. We got people that put their hands on the Bible. There hasn't been a president literally within my lifetime that I now look back on and realize whether it was because they were evil or whether it because they were coerced. I'm not sure. I don't know their hearts, but I can see the actions. And I know that there was not one of them, no, not one, that honored their oath and that didn't lead the United States and indeed the world down this same path, away from Yah and towards a different master. The point of this is kind of begins to show up in a couple stories. Well, let's do this one to set the rest of the stage. Oklahoma, there's a child-friendly statue of Satan in the form of Baphomet that is being discussed by the Grounds Committee for the Oklahoma State Capitol. The Preservation Commission has been asked by the Satanic Temple of New York to place a privately funded statue of Satan, complete with pentagram and two fawning children on Lucifer's knee on the Capitol grounds near a monument of the Ten Commandments. Satan is depicted as Baphomet with a goat's head and horns, boy on his left, girl on his right. It's a fairly traditional character, said Lucian Greaves, spokesperson for the Satanic Temple, to the TV channel in Oklahoma. It offers a lap that visitors can come sit on and have their picture taken with. Others are saying, you know, over our dead body, but hey, you know, if they've been to an airport lately, they can see things happening right there that a lot of people would have said at one time, no, over my dead body, will I get in a chamber and have my body microwaved or my wife's breasts groped? Well, there you go. See? Times change. I'm talking about things that would seem to be in your face and that would seem to be, on the other hand, things that we couldn't have believed a few years ago that would happen, and yet here they are. Is it because Americans are stupid, or have they been blinded? As you know, I quote Isaiah 66, they've been blinded. Now on to this piece. This comes from Harmon Taylor. Now, Harmon is a former attorney. When I put on the legal hat and talk about things from the standpoint of what constitutes law in the United States, both now and in the past, there was a time where real law and legalism were the same. In other words, where what was legal was the same as what was lawful, constitutional, in accord with Scripture. That's no longer true. Now we have to make sure we understand there's a difference between what's lawful and what's legal. It is lawful for you to keep a firearm and not have to have anybody telling you you can or can't. But it may not be legal. If you've entered into a deal with the devil, entered into contracts with the inhabitants of the land, things that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh said don't do, well, then you may have contracted away, just like Esau did, your birthright. As Ben Franklin put it, traded essential liberty for a little temporary security. What's legal and what's lawful aren't the same, and part of the key to that is understanding there now is, in the United States, private law. That's why people that are peons, that are serfs, that are taxpayers, that are U.S. citizens, whether they like it or not, whether they understand it or not, they didn't read the fine print, no longer have God-given rights. They have privileges granted by, well, Baphomet, the Lord of the Flies, Beelzebub, the Emperor, the Fuhrer, pick your poison. So, where Harmon is coming down here is this idea of war and the beast And he likes to use the terminology of the beast. I think it's a decent terminology. You look at the statue of Baphomet. You look at the emperor sitting on the beast throne, and you say, okay, it's pretty darn appropriate symbolism. Here's how he puts it. I'm going to quote from one of his latest newsletters. God does not commence war against the innocent. Elohim protects the innocent. He says, God, I'm going to change it to Elohim just so that we make sure we know who we're talking about. Elohim commences war as a judgment against the guilty, against those who are in rebellion to him. And then he quotes, you know, essentially paraphrases Israel over the years, saying that they might claim to love God, but their actions show that they don't. They walk in rebellion to him. They prefer to be in judgment, to be at a perpetual state of war, to even be taken away and dispersed throughout the lands of the enemy, rather than to walk in obedience. And he says, and this is going to upset a few folks, that if you go back and you look at what's happened with the Bundy family, that too is the message there. Okay? Even the Bundy family, in other words, has made a deal with the devil that they may not be aware of. And the key he understands and keeps pointing out is, do not make agreements with the beast. Make no treaty with the inhabitants of the land. Whether people realize it or not, they've entered into various kinds of gotcha agreements with the present beast system. Now, the whole message of chapter 25 here is about knowing up front how it is that we're entering into contracts in his land. And in his land for bondage, too. That if somebody needs to repay a debt and they have to go sell themselves as a bondservant, the way that you calculate this, the way that you understand it up front, so that we're dealing with brothers honestly, is this land is not to be sold in perpetuity. This slave, not really a slave, is a bondservant, is not to be sold in perpetuity. He's to go free at the next Jubilee or the Shemitah year. How do we figure out? Well, we know how long it is going to be until then. Well, in the United States, see, we don't have that. A slave's a slave's a slave forevermore. Once you make that deal with the devil, as far as they're concerned, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, your children's children's children belong to us too. Ha ha, what are you going to do about it? Don't you have a marriage license? Read the fine print. So what they've gotten is various gotcha agreements with the present beast system. That's by the way, again, why it is that the peons don't have a right to keep and bear arms. Slaves do not have a right to keep and bear arms. If somebody can tell you what property you can and cannot own, then they, you know, you are his servant whom you submit yourselves to obey. Paul got that one absolutely, positively nailed. You submit yourself to the beast? Oh, yes, beast. I want your benefits. I'll sign up for your deal. Well, then read the fine print. So, the beast system now has the authority under law and using weapons that the beast is allowed to have, that the peons aren't, to enforce those gotcha agreements to the fullest extent necessary to fund and to accomplish the beast purposes. And he says when it comes to folks like the Bundys, they may be good folks, they may be sincere folks, they may be God-fearing folks in a way, but because they've entered into those obligations, we know. Why? Well, one of the fruits is that there are these various federal trial court rulings against the family. They went into Satan's beast court and they said, give us a ruling. What do you think Satan's court's going to rule? Satan's right, you're wrong, right? Whether you like the term Satan or not doesn't matter. If it's an adversarial system that is not bound by the rule of law or the Torah or the instruction of the Creator, and they're not, whatever it is, folks, it ain't the God of the Bibles. There's not one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. In other words, another way to put it is, by going into the system and supplicating themselves and saying, oh, beast, give me judgment, they have granted jurisdiction. And here's how Harmon puts this, too. And this is an interesting this comment. He says, many who reject these court rulings as fraud actually are rebelling against Elohim, who gave us our present reality, and he allowed this present system, as part of our, if you will, rebellion and our exile, to come into place. So those who insist on going to those courts and seeing these legal proceedings, but who refuse to learn that reality, have been blinded by Elohim. What did he say? I will choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. Know anybody that's afeared of the federal courts? So, since we're addicted to war, he says, we'd rather take up arms and die pointlessly fighting a beast that we were warned don't make war with anyway. Why? Because the whole purpose of the beast, whether it was Nebuchadnezzar or Babylon or the Chaldeans or any number of other antagonists throughout biblical history and indeed world history, same story applies. They were brought forth by Elohim to bring judgment, to devour and destroy the rebellious, and to send them into exile. So what he says we need to do instead is learn the commercial ways of the beast so as to recognize the problem for what it is and then begin this process of coming out. Here's the key. The Show of Force by Baphomet, by the BLM, by the FBI, by all of these minions of Satan who walk in men's shoes is smoke and mirrors. Because none of us can be compelled, I'm going to say it differently than Harmon does, none of us can be compelled to serve another god. None of us can be compelled by a show of force into a gotcha agreement. We don't have to sign on the dotted line. They can kill us, but they cannot make us worship the other god and accept his law instead of the instruction of our Creator. And to my mind, folks, that is the single most important thing here. Looking back at the Torah portion this week, faith. Are we going to plant in the seventh year, or are we going to have faith? Are we going to walk and give His land its Sabbaths? Or are we going to say, no, we don't trust Him. We're going to do what the other beast here says to do. Choose this day whom you will serve. Simultaneously, he says, none of that show of force by the suicidal and God-defying patriots, whether they admit it or not, whether they know it or not, can get them out of these gotcha agreements either. When the smoke clears and the bodies are buried, he says, the paperwork will still remain. The only thing that will have changed is the population. Now, here's the line that's kind of interesting, because I know this stuff is difficult for folks to hear. And it seems, you know, I always get very, very similar questions. Well, yeah, I think I understand this, but how do we get out of this? The system is so pervasive, it's so powerful, it's so scary. Folks throughout history, Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, the Chaldeans, the Medes, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, they were all scary, scary dudes. The Roman Empire was the scariest bunch of gladiatorial, centurion bad guys the world had ever seen. People were terrified of them. Many were upset that the Mashiach didn't come and whack on them. Maybe that's why he's not the Mashiach. He didn't whack on them. Hey, you know what? The message is still the same. If you're feared of the wrong guy, if you're still, whether you admit it or not, ultimately, not putting your faith in the true God, but instead walking in fear of the one that seems to be the God of this world, we got problems. I see the comment on the screen. I'll just read it because it's a good one. Federal courts sure scale the you-know-what out of me. I don't want to ever go in front of them. Well, may it be that we don't. May it be that a whole bunch of stuff that's bad doesn't happen, right? But the point is, just like I was talking before about fear, having people's fears brought upon them. People in the time of Solzhenitsyn were afraid, you know, of, is not a knock on the door, the door being kicked down at 2 in the morning and somebody coming in and hauling them away to the gulag. Was there a court involved there? Well, kind of. They may or may not have perfunctorily thrown them in front of a court and said, here you go, here's your trial. Oops, you're guilty. Off to Siberia with you. In the United States, they've just had the Supreme Court rule again. We're not going to even hear the case. Don't even bother. We already know the answer anyway. We're just going to rubber stamp the decision. So why not just dispense with the formality of bothering with the court? Hey, the U.S. Fascist state is more ruthlessly efficient than either Stalin or Hitler's. That's where we seem to be headed. So may that not come to pass, but the point is, if we're afraid of that, and if we're walking, therefore, in rebellion to God, even if we don't think we are, fearing the wrong thing, he says, I will choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. There's a line from Job that's a little bit startling, right? That which I feared most has come upon me. Those are the kind of things we need to be aware of as we think about how it means, what it means to walk in faith before Him. It might be, in other words, that letting your land lie fallow in the seventh year is not as tough of an order as some of the things that we may see as a result of having been so disobedient and living in a society that has so forgotten Him. All right, now back to where Harmon was headed next. He says he's still challenged from time to time to try and justify God's support of the legal position of the beast. In other words, how can a loving God, you've heard this before, allow an Adolf Hitler or a Stalin or an Obama to come to power and do the kinds of evil things with drones or with Nazi stormtroopers or with robotic field infantry units that seem to be in plan? How can the loving God of the universe allow these gotcha agreements to be enforced? Answer, because He warned us. Because He does nothing but first declaring His intention through His servants, the prophets. Because He told us, just like He told Joshua, make no treaty with the inhabitants of the land. And then when the Gibeonites came, He should have known better. They lied. They cheated. If you don't know the story, the Gibeonites were the ones that essentially came from the opposite end of the valley as Joshua was marching through the land, taking the land back, town by town. And they told him, oh, we've heard you're a really bad set of dudes, and we want to make a treaty with you. And look, see, we got these old wineskins and these old sandals, and oh, we've been traveling forever and forever. So please, let us serve you. Make a treaty with us. Joshua should have known better. He knew the commandments. He got suckered in. It was fraud. Well, that makes it null and void, right? It was a lying contract. No, that's not what Elohim told David centuries later and Solomon after him. This treaty with the Gibeonites shouldn't have been done, but it was. Now you're going to honor it. I'm going to enforce it. He is a covenant-keeping Elohim. He warns us, and if we make deals with the devil, he will still tell us, I'm really sorry. Have you learned your lesson? Now then the question is, what do we do then? If we have learned our lesson, maybe it's time to get on our knees and repent and teshuvah and say, please, get me out of here. Help me. Show me what I need to do at this point. May that be so. So yeah, Harmon too mentions the Gibeonites. That's a classic case. They were flagrantly defrauded into that bogus treaty. But nevertheless, God protected them. David arrested seven descendants of Saul's and then turned them over to the Gibeonites. And they were warned. He enforced the treaty made by Israel in his name, as Harmon puts it. There's no question they committed common law fraud, no question. But by Israel attaching Elohim's name to the agreement, that means they needed to abide by it, period. End of story. So, when all is said and done, if he allows the beast to do the things that he is clearly allowing it to, we got to be very, very careful. We don't make war with the beast. We come out of the beast system. Choose this day whom you will serve. If you are to serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, then serve him. Serve him alone. Observe his statutes, his judgments, his commandments. Do not enter into treaties with the inhabitants of the land. Don't get their marriage licenses. Don't use their money if you can possibly avoid it. And we can. We can begin to come out of all of those things, even though it may be difficult, even though it may mean we can't get cable service. Don't turn your children via marriage licenses over to the state. What is so obvious, he says, is so hard to see. All of that's the proof, and I've already quoted Isaiah 66, of the power of Elohim to bind and to blind those who will enter into those agreements and who he therefore has warned, I'm going to blind you. I'm going to choose your delusions. We are all, in fact, if we're buying into the lies we're seeing here, we're all double-minded at this point. You hear things like, look ye how evil this government is. Look at how innocent we are in this whole matter. He's got a copy of the Bundy's letter that Ammon Bundy wrote. Now again, these are admirable folks. I don't have a problem with the fact that they believe they're doing the right thing. And I don't have a problem with the fact that to the extent that all of us have been duped the same way. We're talking about a universal problem here. But ultimately, we have to start realizing if we have been duped and deceived, the only answer is teshuvah. Turn. Come out of the system. As he puts it, the beast exists. The system exists to devour and to destroy the rebellious. What's the key source of that rebellion? Well, we already know it. Scripture makes this abundantly clear. It's worshiping false god. The pagan practices. Yeah. And I'm still talking about things that get people into trouble. Christianity. By the way, Judaism is ultimately no different in this respect. Both of them, both the northern and southern kingdoms, as you know, have walked in rebellion. But most of us have more familiarity with the modern paganism of Christianity than we do with the ancient pagan practices of pagan Judaism that they picked up in Babylon and so forth. I'm talking Christmas and Ishtar. Talked about those things in the past. Oh, God knows my heart. Well, you know what? He does. And that's why he's chastening entire peoples. Come out of that stuff. Over and over again, his scripture tells us the same story. You cannot worship foreign gods and say that that is pleasing to me. You cannot taint yourself with this blood, with these idols, with all of this evil, and expect anything other than the land will vomit you out and the result of which will be death. Those who like war and being subject to tyranny, as Harmon concludes, and injustice, don't have to do anything different. Just keep on walking the path you're walking. It ends up in the very same place. Absolutely in death. Keep up the pagan practices. All that war and tyranny and injustice that one could possibly hope for, you can see it right here. It's right smack in front of us. What's hard about this is the coming out. You know it. I know that we're going to see questions, and if people don't put the questions on the screen, if they want to, that's great. We'll address them, but I'm going to address a few of them right now. Well, gee, Mark, how about my Social Security check? How about my this? How about my that? I got to have my aid to families with dependent children. I can't live without it. Well, you can't live with it. And I guess what that means is there's going to be a whole lot of people that aren't going to live. Oh, it hurts me to say that. How much do we need to come separate from? Well, as much as he tells us to. How hard is it going to be? Awfully. Does it mean that eventually we won't have the web, or that we're going to be felons or domestic terrorists? You know where it's going to head. Look what happened in Nazi Germany. Look what has happened throughout history. Those people, well, we're told this in various places. The things that Yeshua said, the world will hate you for my sake, is probably about as true of an assessment looking forward as you can possibly expect. The world hates his instruction. It hates his word. It hates him. And if it hated him, it's going to hate us who walk in obedience to him and love him. What Harmon is talking about here is, by the way, don't even get duped into this constitutional stuff. And this bugs me a little bit. I, like many of you, started coming out of and understanding the Constitution. Now today, if you ask me, well, what's my position? Does the Constitution apply? I'm going to say, well, of course not. Obviously not. Do you have a right to keep and bear arms that shall not be infringed? Clearly not. Big Brother's going to tell you not. It's a federal crime for you to so much as point a gun at somebody who's violating his oath before God to come and take your guns away. How can that be if we have a constitution? Clearly, it doesn't apply. The question is, how do we get here? Harmon puts it this way. We do not now, nor have we ever had a constitutional government. What we had is a federal system. And understand, federal means federal, as in by agreement. You make a deal with the devil, bad stuff happens. It is because Elohim is now fully allowing us to destroy ourselves. Not that he wants that, but he's warned us. You reap what you sow. Rebellion reaps curses. If you ask, he'll tell you that. As we come out, we're going to have to really learn to walk in agreement. So So, yeah, there's I had some note passed to me about, and, you know, one example. There are hundreds, thousands of examples we can see looking around. There's a store in Boulder, friend pointed out, that won't take cash or checks. Only plastic. Only the fake stuff. It's about like me saying 10 years ago, you know, there'll come a time when you won't be able to get on an airplane without somebody groping your gonads. Might as well fly naked. Oh, no, come on, Mark, that could never happen. Of course it's happening. There are so many, literally everything that we look out today, if we'd have told somebody 10 years ago that this was happening today or that was happening or any of a dozen stories that I've mentioned in the news today, people say that could never happen. And the answer? What did Solomon tell us? There's nothing new under the sun. The cycle repeats. What has been is what shall be. And what was done is what shall be done. And there is really nothing new under the sun because human nature hasn't changed. So where are we at on the timeline? Love of money is the root of all evil, says one of the lines. If we understand the money system, I believe, and if we understand some of those things, it's probably the best indicator of where we are and where we're headed. When the money system collapses, if it's allowed to collapse completely, I think what's going to happen instead is we're going to get transitioned to another fake. People are going to suffer. They're going to be duped and deceived as to how that plays out. But as it begins to do the things that it's now obviously doing, for those that have eyes to see and ears to hear, we'll have some indications of where we are time-wise. So I'm looking at a piece by one of my very favorite guys when it comes to the economic side of things, is Jim Willey. And he points, hey, let's look at history first. The quintessential timeline points to guarantee the national failure of the almighty dollar are several. First, the creation of the Federal Reserve back in 1913. Along with it, the enforcement arm of the fiat money system, the IRS. Tricky Dick Nixon abrogated the Bretton Woods gold standard, August of 1971. Glass-Steagall was removed in 1999. And in 1999, also, most favored nation trading status was given to China, all of which allowed the destruction and the complete undermining of the industrial United States. All of this, as he points out, was motivated and it was intentional. Let me say that again. They're not stupid. They're serving another master. It was motivated and intentional, and it goes way back. Some people are probably thinking, oh, well, how about killing Kennedy? If you can kill a sitting U.S. president, if you can literally execute him in front of people. Now, admittedly, we didn't have video phone cameras in those days. Only had one Zapruder film to steal and deal with. And only had allegedly one shooter who accomplished a feat that no one in history before or since has been able to duplicate, including firing the magic bullet. Well, if you can kill a president in plain view of a whole bunch of people and then lie to people for 50 years and cover it up, what can't you do? Answer? Pretty soon you can get them naked and getting on airplanes. You can tell them that they got to give their children to Molech. This man with the blue gloves wants to feel your daughter up. I guess so, if it makes me feel safe. Come on! So, here's how he puts it today. Let's talk about where we are. Let's suppose you were a couple of nations. I'm not going to play the ruse. He goes through it, say, he calls them A and B for a while, and then later tells you who the two nations are. Well, we know who they are. They're China and Russia. Two nations, A and B, China and Russia, they want to launch an alternative fake currency, but they're going to claim that it's backed with gold, right? They've been buying gold hand over fist. They're looking to be your world reserve currency. And if they were able to pull this off, but they weren't careful, what's going to happen? Well, as he notes, they would be victims of their own success. Unless they had enough critical mass when they began to make the change. The reason is because this new currency that everybody would say, well, that's better, it's backed by gold, would sharply rise in exchange rate. It's better, people want it more, it goes up in value. But what does that mean? It means that all the things that they were trying to sell to the world, the commodities, the oil, the natural gas, the machine tools, the cars, whatever it is that their country was trying to export would be far more expensive because their currency is dear, it's valuable. Then they lose because it literally, you know, they shoot themselves in the foot because all the other currencies are toilet paper. They get cheaper. So, if only these one or two nations tried to launch this strong value-backed or gold-backed new currency, it would quickly rise 30 to 50%. And then they would suffer a huge slam to their export trade, and that would price them out of the global market. They'd suffer. They'd be victims of their own successful currency. So, that's a problem. How are we going to do this? Now, this, again, is part of the reason we can tell where we are today. How are we going to do this? They wait. Instead of launching prematurely their gold-backed currency, they need to build a trade zone. You can think BRICS here, by the way, and form a growing alliance of participating nations. How many times have we talked about this over the last year? China inks trade deal with Brazil, with Australia. Russia inks trade deal with this country. Iran is going to do business and trade for oil. Uh-oh, this will get them invaded. Not in dollars, but in gold or yuan or something else. More BRICS, more nations joining the trade bloc. They build a trade zone with participating nations to get to a point where they have a critical mass, say at least 60% of all the global trade. Now, when the moment is right, the supporting system is truly ready and they've reached critical mass. They launch the new gold-backed currency, they announce the new trade settlement system, and they make known the new banking procedures with the new currency, and they do so with an armada of nations in support. And now, where are you going to go? Alternative-wise, the rest of the world can literally go to you-know-where, down their own self-inflicted toilet. And they benefit from growth as opposed to having been victims of their own success. So that's what he suggests is happening. I'm going to say, yeah, it's a very reasonable analysis. But what's interesting is what follows next. What you got next are swing states. They figure in the chessboard strategy. And Jim Willie identifies four that are crucial to bringing this about. One is Germany. Another is Turkey. Another is the Ukraine. And finally, Saudi Arabia. And when you compare, you know, the rest of the world, yep, the rest of the world is mired in fraud. The system is coming apart. There was a big suit this week announced. I didn't spend much time talking about it today. More and more people claiming, yes, gold market's being manipulated, just like LIBOR scandal. Sure, it's crooked. Everybody knows it. They're going to the U.S. courts and expecting a resolution. I truly doubt it. About the only thing that they may succeed in doing, at least, is getting more people to wake up to it. But here we go through those four. Germany, it's critical, and he believes it'll flip. Either it has to abandon the sinking West or go down with it. Recently, you see more commercial ties with Russia. Things like heavy rail, liquefied natural gas facilities, and, of course, natural gas shipments themselves. Germany knows darn well that they need the natural gas that Gazprom, the big Russian company, can sell them. And a lot of that gas is going to come through the pipelines in the Ukraine. Over 90% of corporate heads in Germany favor ditching the West and forming stronger ties with Russia. It will flip, he says. The only question is when. Turkey, too, is critical. It will flip. It, for years, generations, has served as the hub between East and West. The Bosporus Straits for shipping are key. And they're a wild card to NATO as well because of the bases that are there. The other thing is that Turkey's for thousands of years been a gold intermediary when it comes to banking. And when Turkey flips, a lot of other smaller Middle Eastern nations like Pakistan and Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan will flip as well. Ukraine, of course, is on the list, and he says there's a trap been set there. They've got a notable recent history when it comes to fraudulent banking. They served in the Nigerian online fraud schemes. Interesting, isn't it? A lot of hacking schemes, every conceivable type of scummy operation, including sex trafficking of women. I wonder where the Nigerian Boker Boko Haram are planning on selling their women, those girls through. Maybe it is, in fact, Ukraine. Isn't that interesting? It's a lawless land. Remember this scam here not long ago? Their gold was shipped to the United States and so forth and so on. They had a democratically elected government. It was put down. And the whole situation is just absolutely scummy. They're the transit point for Russian natural gas pipelines. They possess some of the richest farmland in the world, too. Very much like the U.S. state of Iowa. But it was Putin that laid the trap. And the West, with its black ops under control of CIA Langley, in league with the NATO mercenaries and under control of the George Soros types, he notes, swooped into the trap. So, the rest of the Eastern nations are observing with a keen eye the removal of the Ukrainian central bank gold to New York and the absconding with some $70 billion of Ukrainian funds to Swiss bank locations. They're watching. The store shelves in Ukraine are already being emptied. Shortages with price inflation are the current reward. When Ukraine and its neighbors begin to flip, that will pull a lot of the eastern nations along with them. Many smaller nations like Romania, Bulgaria, maybe even Poland and Hungary. Of course, there's been a lot of stories about Poland of late and U.S. bases and air support there. Maybe they'll follow. Remember that Poland and Hungary depend almost 100% on Russian natural gas. There's some real battlegrounds here. Putin may want to slap Poland down for offering staging grounds for the U.S. Stormtroopers who invaded Kiev. Finally, it comes to Saudi Arabia, which is also critical. And not only will it flip, but it may have already done so. This nation has been the linchpin of the petrodollar and leading the OPEC nations. Their oil has already been heavily depleted, but the Chinese have come into the tent. They're funding huge projects like a vast petrochemical facility near the Red Sea, and they're planning more. The recent Chinese missile deal, and they even had a parade, should serve as a clear indicator of what's coming next. Chinese will become the new protectorate role. And with the UAE and with Saudi Arabia, the Gulf region, literally, they say, has already been conquered. Finally, enter Iran, where the OPEC oil cartel under Saudi guidance will be replaced by that natural gas co-op that Russia's building with Gazprom. The Iranian gas pipelines are strategically important, and all of a sudden, when you look at it this way, the Saudis become expendable. And even the royal succession tells you what's going on there. So basically what he's saying is, while we still can't know exactly the timing of the system, the sequence becomes predictable. Here, back to the United States, you've got the vapor taper going on. I've been calling it the vapor taper for a long time. Stories this week saying, hey, isn't it funny? The Fed is claiming that they've cut back from $85 billion a month, $10 billion here, $10 billion now. They're not purchasing nearly as much of the U.S.'s own debt with newly printed money. But what's happened instead? All of a sudden, out of the blue, as China and Japan aren't purchasing our bogus debt anymore, suddenly bankrupt Belgium emerges as the big player buying all this U.S. debt. For crying out loud, where'd they get the money? Who's kidding who? In other words, it's a scam and a sham, and probably what's going on here is that Belgium is being used as an intermediary by the Fed to pretend to buy U.S. bonds. So, he says the toxic currency regime has been cornered and exposed as dependent on hyper-money printing in a vast scheme of hidden support for the banking derivatives, very obviously proxy support by Belgium and through Japan, too. So the major players are not fooled by the scam here. What's expected is that the Chinese yuan will soon be given full convertibility. The announcement to be made by Russia and China and the Saudis will settle oil and gas trade in yuan and in rubles, and that will upset the apple cart, blow the doors off the global financial system. The pact that's coming will center upon energy trade payment as a core, but it'll be used in general for trade worldwide. And the resulting effect might trigger a U.S. bank derivative meltdown, possibly one in Japan as well. And the BRICS nations will start central bank functions and begin to convert U.S. bonds to gold. And eventually the number of BRICS associates, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, that will approach 100 nations. Other minor players like Vietnam, Bolivia, and Indonesia will join along with Iran. So, ultimately, you know, we can see at least what's going on. Other indicators of the timeline: Russian Air Force gave a demonstration not long ago to the U.S. Navy of their advanced radar jamming equipment. They literally blinded a U.S. ship and flew by a number of times over and over again as their targeting systems were shut down. And then there's been this recent parade that we mentioned in Saudi Arabia to show off new Chinese missiles. Basically, the Saudis have already divorced the United States. They're beginning to crawl under the wing of China. And he expects that as a result, U.S. will treat the Saudis to some terrorism, a false flag. Got to punish Saudi Arabia while the London bankers continue to steal their gold. And he says it this way, we've mentioned this before, the U.S. dollar isn't going to tank directly, but it will suffer a rapid decline. It'll probably be involved with something that we've seen before, and that's a dual currency, a U.S. internal currency, which he calls the Scheiss dollar. I won't elaborate on that, but it means that it's not what you call really good stuff. It will rapidly devalue, more so than the overseas dollar, which will still devalue, but not quite as rapidly. All this being done in a series of steps. Expect severe problems, he said, inside the U.S. Price inflation will come out of control. Supply chain disruption and violence. Look for violence at gasoline stations, in particular, food markets, and at ATMs with cash. Solution, he believes, is in gold and silver. I think, at least economically, there's truth in that. But the real issue, of course, is come out of her. So let's pause there. I know there's at least a question or two that I didn't get to yet. So type them up, and we'll get them up on the screen if there's other ones while I'm looking at the one that's there now. Okay, question. If you fly a plane, don't you have a license to fly? That puts you in their system, does it not? Yes and no. And I'm going to try to be as – we've talked about things like this before. Same thing could be said about driver's license, although it's a slightly different situation. I think the situation with a marriage license is far more clear, so I'll come back to that one in a second. Typically with a plane – There's a historic difference, and it's even, although there's similar claims that could be made, it's even a little bit different with a plane than it is with a car. And the reason is because what a pilot's license technically is often better described, if you go back and look at the history, as a certificate of competency. It's not so much a license as a certificate of competency. In other words, the claim is made that if you fly a plane and you're incompetent, you could literally not only kill yourself or kill the people that are in the plane with you, you could crash into somebody else and kill them from out of the blue. So the claim, at least, is that somebody is saying, okay, look, this person is competent not to kill somebody else in the process of doing whatever it is. That's, by the way, the claim, of course, that's been extended to almost everything. That's why you can't have a gun. That's why you can't farm, because you might give a rutabaga to somebody else and poison them. So we're rapidly getting to the point where any claim that's based on safety will say, you peons, you cannot be trusted to pick your nose without a license from Big Brother because you might kill somebody. We're getting there. If you go back and look at the driver's license, what you'll see is that in general, the driver's license is a commercial certificate. It's what used to be called a chauffeur's license or a commercial driver's license. You'll find that in the laws of most states, although they've rapidly been moving by precedent to change them, that you still technically do not need a driver's license except when you're in commercial operation. If you just want to take your wife to church or to a fellowship that meets on Shabbat, better, you do not need a driver's license. You're not engaged in a commercial operation. If you want to hire yourself out as a cabbie, then you need to, because now, see, you're engaged in commerce. So once you begin to see how this nexus works, a lot of things fall into place. Now, here's where we're headed, and this is the key with the driver's license and the pilot's license and so many other things. Is there anything, ultimately, if you see where it's headed, is there anything that Big Brother can't say, you need my permission to do, to buy or sell? Well, answer is nothing. Not once you've been sucked into that system. Literally, you're a peon, you're a slave. There's nothing that you can that you cannot be mandated to ask permission to do. So it has been done by design. Now, there's a couple of things as a matter of practice that I will suggest that we do. There's some things that I do, for example. I don't sign anything anymore. My signature, if you will, I'm going to phrase it this way. My signature nowadays includes the words "without prejudice." Because there is a there's an obscure part of the Uniform Commercial Code that says when you enter into contracts, you have a choice of law. Now, this is something that's about a 40-hour discussion. I kind of alluded to it with Harmon's concept about buy agreement and so forth. In court, you'll hear, is this your signature? Is this your signature? Did you sign this? Did you enter into this agreement with the beast? Did you sell your soul to the devil? Answer, no. That's not my signature. Why? Well, because my signature includes the words "without prejudice," which basically says I am reserving my rights to serve my king and my creator and my God, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and him alone. And your law, by the way, the law that you're using to try to enforce this gotcha agreement actually says somewhere that I have a choice. And that as long as I exercise that choice and make it clear, and this is what I'm doing now and what I'm advising other people to do, by our fruit, by our walk, by everything that we are and say and do, we need to say, we serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and him alone. We serve the creator and king of this universe. Him we worship and no other. But, see, we're going to presume that you serve because you're driving a car, because you're breathing in our air. You belong to Caesar. Well, you're wrong. I rebut the presumption. In other words, there's all kinds of little legal traps and gotchas. Failure to object in a timely fashion means you have agreed. Well, then I'm objecting, period. Now and forever. Know this, right? I hope this is clear. In the system, somebody asked a question about Social Security numbers, taking the benefits. There's all kinds of ways, you've heard me refer to them as the fish hooks in the flesh, all kinds of ways you can get into the system, and no way that they're going to tell you to get out of the system. It's all about trying to tell you you're a slave, presuming you're a slave. If you fail to object, you're a slave. If you take our license, you're a slave. If you've entered into a deal with us, you're a slave. Ultimately, the idea is you won't so much be able to breathe, you won't be able to grow a garden. You won't be able to have a chicken or plant a rutabaga or anything else without them saying, see, you've agreed. You've got the Clive and Bundys that said, well, see, we've had our cows on this land for over 100 years, but now we own that land. Well, technically, we can't own the land if you read the Constitution. Literally, Constitution says they don't have any right to own this land. They got some dodges. They got some Clintonian schemes. Things get really, really murky. How do you possibly navigate the maze, right? How can you possibly know enough? You can't. Ultimately, all you can do is to say, look, Father, I'm counting on your protection. I'm going to keep your Sabbaths. I'm going to do what you say, and I'm going to count on you to protect me. If I keep your Shabbat, your Shemitah year in the land, will you honor your part of the deal? Yeah, you'll have plenty to eat. Okay, Abba, if I will keep your feasts, if I'll do the best that I possibly can to keep your instruction, to walk as best as I can in my flawed human way according to your will you protect me, Father? That's all I need. It's all I care about. That's how we know the people that will come to us and ask. That's how we can build communities. That's how we can do all these things that are so important. Does it mean that we cannot take certain licenses? Well, you know, do you have a driver's license? I possess one. Here's the question if somebody asks me, do I need it? Do I need it? Hey, I'm not going to operate a motor vehicle, but I might be driving a car. You see? It's all about the words. Oh, but we can trap you. We can trick you. We can change the meaning of words. Yeah, you can. I'm just going to tell you, I have this thing. Look at my driver's license. It's going to say right there on it, signed here, without prejudice. You know what that means? Even if you don't know what it means, I know what it means. And more importantly, the one I serve knows what it means. I have not agreed. You're going to ask me, here's the way Harmon Taylor phrases it, by the way. You claim that I belong to you, servant of Satan? Show me the agreement. Show me the signature. If you can't, I'm going to tell you, you got no agreement. Can you kill me? Have you got a gun? You can kill me. You're going to have to deal with my master. I'm going to just simply walk in obedience to him. Folks, we cannot prevent people who are evil and serve the other master from doing the bad things that they have literally sold their soul to the devil, if you want to use that terminology, in order to be able to do. But we can walk in obedience to the Creator. We can do the very best. Are they going to call us slaves and presume that we're slaves? You bet. Are we slaves? No. We serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and Him alone. And we've got His Shemitah and His Yovel, His Jubilee to look forward to. Don't know exactly when they're going to happen now. Okay, so we got lots of questions. I think I probably raised more questions there than I answered. I know those are kind of things that come up frequently. We've talked about before. Are we going to deal with people who have had their delusions picked for them? Who are going to suffer from fear? Who are going to hate those who serve a different master? Absolutely. We've been warned about all of that. Do I know how it's going to play out? No. I laid out some things from the article by Jim Willey that I think give us some event scheduling understanding. When we start to see things happening, when you see Germany join the trade union, when you see Turkey flip, when you see what's happening in Ukraine play out, when you see Saudi Arabia, we'll know that certain things are on the horizon. Okay? All of these are part and parcel of what's going on. I've said for years that if you see World War III, you're going to see a currency collapse almost simultaneously. I mentioned earlier this idea of the possible EMP event or grid down event. Well, what can we possibly do? Answer. If your life depends on the power grid and the power grid goes down, you're going to have two choices. A, get right with God real fast, or B, die, or maybe both. The time to realize that if I'm dependent on the power grid, if I have a medical condition that I need an iron lung or I need certain drugs that come through a system that I have to be able to get them on a daily or weekly basis, and those drugs aren't available, and I turn into a nutcase, like if they're SSRIs, I better get off of that. Better get free of that pharmacopoeia now. If there are other things that if the power grid goes down, result in my imminent demise, I had better have some alternatives, and I better start thinking about it now. There are options, solar power, other things. You can certainly be off-grid. I think that provides a degree of separation and a degree of security. Is that a final answer, right? If there's an EMP that goes off directly overhead, is it going to whack the solar panels and the connections to your inverters and electronics and maybe take them out? Absolutely, it's possible. People ask the question, well, how do you know, right? Can you protect them? Can you shield them? What can you do? Well, and I tell people it's a little bit like asking the question, if I get shot with a bullet, am I going to die? Answer, maybe. How big a bullet? Where did it hit you? If it hits an artery, it's a whole lot different deal than if it doesn't. So is an EMP going to take out my solar panels or yours? I don't know. How big? Where did it hit? How long are the wires in your system? Whole bunch of questions. But all of these things, the answer simply boils down to begin to get ourselves right with our Creator, return to Him, ask Him what we ought to be doing, begin moving in that direction. If we're in a major city, if you're in a place in America, if I was in New York City, folks, no way in hell would I want to be in, well, hell, New York City. I look at Mayor Bloomberg or this latest socialist scumbag that's in there and say, you know, these people are nuts. They're living in a place where they're being treated as absolute slaves. For crying out loud, I don't even want to say it. I cannot think of a place that I would rather less live than in Rahm Emanuel's Chicago or Bloomberg's New York or whatever the heck this other scumbag that runs that fiefdom now calls it, than those places. Hideous cesspools. When the inevitable happens, I truly believe there will probably be cannibalism in Chicago and in New York and in Los Angeles and in a whole bunch of other places. It's going to be ugly. I don't think people that have been following or not following what's going on have a clue as to how ugly certain parts of the country are going to be. And indeed, that applies to a whole lot of the eastern seaboard because of the population density and so forth. I'm sorry to have to say that, but now, does that mean that the Creator of the universe cannot protect you in those places? No how, no way. There will be people that He will have in all kinds of places doing His work. May Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh protect them and guide them and bless them. Right? You may be told to go somewhere that I wouldn't want to go, or pray that I don't get told to go. Your mileage may vary. That's the standard cop-out. But the point is, now is the time to be watching for the signs and the signposts and knowing the times and the seasons and being aware of what's coming and taking the kinds of preparations that you can. Here's a question. Mark, what kind of problems will be at the ATM machines? Well, obvious ones. A, if the power's down, they don't work. B, if they don't have any paper cash in them, they can't dispense paper cash. C, if the paper cash is worth less...
Yeah, they don't have any digital zeros.
That's right. Then, yeah, how many digital zeros can they make? Oops, we got to put a new printer in the ATM machine because we need a couple of extra quadrillions on the money for this week, right? There's all kinds of reasons why the ATM machines will be bad. If for no other reason than if I was a criminal wanting to steal a few thousand or say $100 million from somebody, where would I want to stake out when I've got the guns and all the other idiots in New York have been disarmed? Answer, pick an ATM machine. Get your buds to hang out there. Just like the gas stations. Just like if you're a lion, the place that you want to go hunt for gazelles is at the watering hole. It really is that simple and that sad. Okay, a question about next week. I'm not sure what that means. Do you have to... here's a good question from Jack and Jay. Do you have to write... Can you use a rubber? I'm just going to paraphrase it. Can you use a rubber stamp to put without prejudice on there, or do you have to write it out? I think the answer is what's key is that the words need to be there. In other words, what I will tell people is if you don't see the words without prejudice associated with my signature, it's not my signature. I simply will not, have not signed anything like that in a long, long time, and won't. And, yeah, rubber stamps are fine. You can go get yourself a rubber stamp. You can put it on your emails and your addresses and all kinds of places if you want to as well. But ultimately, it's about making sure that you understand what you're agreeing to. And the problem is most people don't. And they're going to sign up for agreements and they're saying, I'm going to take this benefit. I'm going to take the benefit, and if there are strings that come along with it, I've signed up for it. So what the law, the statute says, and the Uniform Commercial Code is, by specifying certain words, a person, a people, a creation of the Creator with a soul can say, I am making a different choice of law. I do not want to be bound by that public-private agreement, private law. I want the good old-fashioned constitutional common law. As close as I can get to it. Next week. Oh, next week, could we discuss without prejudice? Okay, I'll make a note of that. If there are some specific questions people want to send me, go ahead and do that. Let me make one other statement about without prejudice, too. It's not a silver bullet. Okay? It's not a magic wand that you wave. It is just one aspect of one indication that you are offering an objection. You see, because you can never constantly keep giving the caveats all the time. You hear me give caveats all the time, right, about the men of Issachar, and I'm saying these things. Don't be depressed about them. You can't always, there was jokes in flying. The FCC or the FAA wanted so many placards. Flying this machine may result in your imminent death. They wanted so many placards on the panel of an airplane that pretty soon you wouldn't be able to see the instruments. Well, there's a point at which placards and postings, danger, danger, Will Robinson, don't do any good. The boy who cried wolf syndrome. You can't constantly be issuing disclaimers and saying, I can't say without prejudice every other word, when I'm on the radio or talking to somebody in public. But what I can do is I can do my very best to walk in obedience to my Creator. I'm going to occasionally make mistakes. I may occasionally forget. I'm not going to forget to not sign my name without prejudice. By the way, when I first heard of this years ago, one of the teachers that was talking about it said, you don't even so much as sign a birthday card. he was a little bit humorous. But without saying without prejudice. So we'll try to make a note of that, and if there's some specific questions, send them to me too. We'll talk about them. Any other questions or comments? I think it's time to start at least thinking about wrapping up here. Book of Lamentations coming to America. Going to be bad, bad, bad. Yeah, all of that's true. I guess I wish I could say it would be different, but on the other hand, I really don't. Because what I'm thankful for is that His word is consistent. We have been told. Literally, it's true. We've been told. We've seen this developing for 100 years with the money system. We've seen it developing for decades and decades with the elimination of everything that has to do with Yah. From the halls of education to the halls of Congress. To the point where now it's a bad parody. Where the President of the United States, or what now passes for it, guy that plays one on TV, can sit on a Game of Thrones chicken throne with feathers and pretend to be the Emperor of the Universe and the return of Quetzalcoatl. And people laugh and say, "Huh, there you go. He's telling us. Right there in our face, he's telling us." Two quick stories as we start to wrap. This is from Charles Hugh Smith. The destabilizing truth. He's got the numbers here. I'm just going to give you the headline. Only the wealthy can now afford a middle-class lifestyle. This has happened right in front of people. You have to, what, the median $50,000 annual income that used to make one middle class. I remember when, by the way, $10,000 made you wealthy. When I graduated from college, folks, this is dating me a little bit here, $13,000 a year was a starting salary for an engineer. Really, really good job. You could buy a nice house on $13,000 a year. That's poverty today. And it hasn't been all that long ago. The truth is obvious, this article says. A middle-class lifestyle is unaffordable to all in the United States today, but the top 20% of all wage earners, of all families, of all homes in the United States. Middle class is no longer middle. It's now upper. And that's happened right in front of people's eyes. Just as they have chosen their own ways. And their soul delights in their abominations. So will I choose their delusion and bring their fears upon them. Because when I called, no one answered. They chose that in which I do not delight. The things that they feared most are coming upon them. Another quick one here. The economics of marriage. This is a good story, but I disagree. The point is interesting. From Michael Snyder. The marriage rate in the United States has now fallen to the lowest level ever recorded. Why is this happening? Why are so many young people choosing not to get married today? Well, he focuses on economics. One big reason is money. Because getting married is a great way to ensure that you're going to be a pauper. Another big reason is the seismic shift in cultural attitudes. Americans, especially young people, don't place the same importance on marriage and having children that they once did. In 1920, there were 92.3 marriages for every 1,000 unmarried women. In 2012, there was a third of that number. We've seen a colossal demographic earthquake. The marriage rate has fallen by an astounding 60% since 1970 alone. Now, here's the problem, folks. You know what? Marriage licenses are a sham anyway. I look back and say, okay, as sad as it is to say, would I invite a young person today to, quote, get married? Answer, hell no! You're going to enter into a license before Big Brother that invites into this supposed holy union an unholy overseer who will not acknowledge the God of the universe and, in fact, will license things that God calls abomination. And you expect to be blessed by that? You can read the Word. Talk about this whenever we go through Exodus chapter 21. Marriage is covenant and contract and then consummation. You don't need Big Brother's license in order to make it a marriage. Nowhere in Scripture do you ever, ever, ever see a man of Yah going before a potentate or a priest or asking for permission from a king to be married. They get permission from the fathers, and that's it. So, what's the big deal here? Well, the point is we're so deceived we don't even understand the issues anymore. People wonder why Department of Child Services or whatever the three-letter initial may be in your own state believe that their people, what people thought were their children belong to the state. Answer, they'll show you in the law. They do. It's another one of those gotcha agreements. So don't be deceived. I guess I'm happy that the rate of marriage is falling. What I'm not happy about is that people don't understand that when they shack up, they are married. At least if they're not walking in adultery in the process. And by the way, you don't have to shack up. You can go out and do it in the back of a Chevy and become married. And you're still married. At least as far as it gets anymore. Such a mess. We've come so far, we just plain don't understand. We don't understand the Agatcha agreements. We don't understand who we serve. And young men today have no clue how many quote-unquote wives they have. The one thing that's obvious, though, is that they're not honoring any of them in a biblical sense. Okay, was there another question?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
There was a verse that, where is that found in the Bible, the verse that he just said? Well, I'm not sure, Destiny, if you can remind me what verse it was. I probably quoted several there. Then I'll tell you where it was said, hopefully. Okay. Yeah, seek him while he might be found, says a comment. And one day he'll close the door of the ark. And yes, as Bill Cosby said,
and it's raining.
Okay, Lord, me and you, right? The time to make that decision is now. Okay, other comments or questions? While we're waiting for people to type, I will check it up. Okay, I don't think I missed any. I do see a comment here, and it summarizes what I've been saying. Once you're in the system, whether it's driver's licenses or other agreements, gotcha agreements, folks, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of gotcha agreements. The old saying is, if you take the king's money, you better play the king's tune.
Register to vote
is probably one of the very, very biggest ones. Declaring yourself to be a taxpayer. Hey, ask yourself this question. I'm just asking it as a question, right? The Fifth Amendment says you're to be free of self-incrimination. What is the bottom line of an IRS 1040 form? Right above your agreement signature, say. I know that any form, a statement on this form can and will be used against me in a court of law. I'm ratting myself out to Big Brother. Come and get me. And you're signing it. How can you do that if the Fifth Amendment applies? Can you be forced into self-incrimination? Well, a free person cannot. But a slave who's already surrendered his rights can. He doesn't have a right to keep and bear arms. He gets groped at airports. By the way, why do they grope you at airports? Because you're there. The presumption is, if you're there, you belong to us. Presumption, precedent, lots and lots of ways to get roped into the system. Very, very few ways to get out. As far as the prince of this world is concerned, once he's got you, there's no way out. Of course, the trouble is that's a lie. Because one thing Scripture tells us is, I have laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing. Therefore, choose life. So say it with me. I choose life, and I choose to have it more abundantly through you, Abba. Guide me. Give me your direction. Show me the path. Help me to walk in obedience to you. If I'm on the wrong path, help me to turn, to shuv, get back to where I belong. Guide me along the way. All right. I don't see any other questions. Then let us close in prayer. And we'll begin with that. Yehua Eloheinu, Yehua Echad. Vehavta et Yehua Eloheka, vekol levavka, vekol nefeshka, vekol meodeka. Hear, O Israel, Yehua is one, and we should serve him with all of our heart and all of our soul and all of our mind. Abba, we come before you. We pray that you'd give us eyes to see and ears to hear. Father, if we've been deceived, and we have, and we know this, help us. Give us eyes to see, ears to hear. Help us to turn. Help us to see what you would have each of us as individuals do today. How do we individually get back on your path? How do we come out of those things that we shouldn't ought to have been into? How can we walk in obedience from here on out? What kinds of things do we need to do to prepare for what's coming? How can we be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming upon the earth? What do we need to do? We know some of the things. We know we need to begin to walk in obedience to keep your feasts, your appointed times. We need to deal with one another honestly. We need to honor our commitments and our word. Help us, Father, to do all of those things. Abba, we pray your blessing on those that we know and love who are walking in rebellion. We have family, wives, or sons or daughters, or husbands, whatever it may be, that we love, that we know are walking in rebellion. They're not listening. They may be committing adultery, or bearing false witness, or engaged in contractual obligations and activities that we say no, they shouldn't be doing. And Father, there's only so much we can do in this world. So we pray that you would be the one to chasten them, to block the path that leads to destruction. to send them witness after witness. If they won't listen to us, send them others, whether it's in their own heart and soul, or whether it's witnesses that we don't even know about, that will make clear your word and your will. Block those paths that lead to death. Touch their hearts, we pray. Soften their hearts. Unstiffen their necks and turn them. Give them every option to see and to return to you, to walk in your ways, to be healed, to be delivered from entities, spirits, people, anything who would lead them to death and destruction, and to return to you. Father, we pray that you would heal our houses, heal our communities. We know that time draws short. Bring us together again in you. Bring our families together, our houses, those that are our neighbors. Help us to be doing the right things, making use of the time, being good and faithful servants. All this we ask in your name. Guide us. Help us to veer neither to the right nor to the left. Hallelujah. Amen. Okay, so I don't think we have any other questions. Again, with that, Shabbat Shalom, and thank you. Never will I go back. I have found my way. Called by my Father, I am here to stay. As long as I'm obedient.